Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Well, big business has had enough of the screwquester, and they're taking to the Capitol, bringing those private planes in. Yeah, you know, kind of makes sense. The hotel people, not happy. Explaining to their Republican handmaidens, if no one's flying, and this is very simple, if no one's flying, no one's staying in hotels. If no one's staying in hotels, no one's paying the hotel association money. And if no one's paying the hotel association money, there are no Hiltons. And what will poor Paris and Nikki do? Well, they won. The Senate has approved a bill that will make sure that the furloughs don't happen, only in there. So your children, you know, screw them. Got to make sure those travelers, they get to the hotels to put money in the coffers. Oh, yes. Anyway, we'll also be talking about the race to the top that seems like it is, well, falling to the bottom. We'll talk about the facts surrounding charters and cyber charters. Also more on the horribly tragic explosion in West Texas. The president spoke today there. He's also at the Bush Library. We'll talk about that. With today being the NFL draft day, we're also going to talk about former players and their struggles and random thoughts of, well, what do the wealth class, what do they think? What do they think is important? I think you'll find it fairly interesting, and you'll want to stick around for that. Also, your thoughts, your questions, your comments, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Our tweet of the day came to us from the governor's office, the governor who claims he is the more jobs governor. Not just the jobs governor, but the more jobs governor. In fact, what he says is 110,000 plus number of jobs the private sector's created since Governor Corbett took office. He is the more jobs governor. Now, what I find interesting about the more jobs governor frame is that state-related jobs, they say, since January of 2011 have dropped by almost 2,000. In fact, I've seen some statistics, upwards of 5,000 jobs have been lost just through state employment. That's not even the reverberation effect into the private sector of those state jobs not spending money in the local economy. Also, in education, through the dramatic, massive, over nonsensical cuts, 20,000 education professionals into the streets. So you're talking 25,000 public sector jobs gone, and how many thousands more with it because of the reverberation effect? Don't really know. But here he is, 110,000 plus private sector jobs, he says. Yet, on one hand, he's cost 25,000 plus all the other ones. And we've seen the statistics out there. We've seen the numbers out there that say, look, you know, in the month of March, the Commonwealth was 49th in the country in job creation. So I see this tweet come to me. He says, he's the more jobs governor, the more jobs governor. And I go, well, I guess more than Wyoming, right? I guess you could give him that. And for a guy who ran on jobs, 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 all he's done is vacation, 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 travel, travel, travel. I mean, I wish I had his travel schedule. France, Chile, Brazil, in Chicago to receive an award. He's forever in D.C. being patted on the back. Is he ever in the governor's mansion? Is he in his office? Because I know a lot of people go over there. They never see him. Which is why I've always called him Punxsutawney Tom. Now, he peeks out every once in a while, brings his bad news, brings his poison, then disappears for a while. And the reality is, look, since his policies have been put in place, our unemployment rate has gone up. Fact. You can't make that up. So when he says he's the more jobs governor, 110,000 private sector jobs, you know, never mind all those public sector jobs lost. I say, you know, and I guess it's in the wording. And this is one of those moments where you go, be careful when you're talking to politicians because they use words very, very specifically. 110,000 jobs, the number of private sector jobs created. How many have we lost? Anybody ask that? Is this a net gain of 110,000? Because the number I just saw put our net loss, understand, a net loss of 6,000. The payrolls of the state shrunk by 6,000 in the month of March. So we've had a net loss over this period. And you go, well, is it that new math? Is it the new math that the Corbett administration brought in? You know, because you kept hearing, oh, there's 70,000 jobs created in the Marcellus Shale. And then when you find out how they calculated it, you go, but that's wrong. That's not even logical. That would be like Linda Thompson, who's the mayor of Harrisburg, saying, I created 5 jobs in the communication department by firing 4 of them. And I love how they do that. Understand how the governor's office calculates what created job. Let's say someone on the Marcellus Shale was needed to drive a truck. So they hire a guy on Monday. On Tuesday, he either quits or he's fired or he gets hurt or whatever. He's gone. They bring in another guy they hire. And he works Tuesday. And by Wednesday, he quits. He gets fired, whatever. He's gone. And Wednesday, the same thing. Thursday, the same thing. Friday, the same thing. You have one truck driver job. But they will say they created 5 jobs because 5 people were hired. And I guess, you know, on one vein, it's accurate. 5 people were hired. But there's only one job. And they only had one day of work. I mean, these are tricky people, man. And it's amazing to me. But for someone who ran on the jobs, jobs, jobs platform, his policies have been bad, bad, bad. And this whole push for the no rights at work agenda, look, all of the ugliness we've seen all around the country, it's coming here, the legislation's here, the whole no rights at work agenda, destroying prevailing wage, destroying collective bargaining, pursuing an end to the 40-hour work. Oh, we need flexibility. Oh, we need to, well, you don't hear them say it in these terms. But what they're really saying is we need to screw those cops and firefighters. And I look at the Eichelberger co-sponsorship memo, who wants to do a collective bargaining for cops and firefighters. And you go, during a time when we're looking at the Boston going, wow, those people are heroes. Those people did what most people would not. And now we're talking about how do we make their lives worse? How do we lower their wages? How do we steal their benefits? And the whole pension discussion in this state is not how do we really fix the pension crisis that they created, not how do we fix it, but how do we destroy it, make it worse so we can do away with it altogether? That's really the direction they want to take this. By arguing, and just from a common sense point of view, by saying, hey, we're going to split this into 2 separate funds, and we're going to have a defined contribution and the defined benefit over here. Just on the face of that, thinking about the pure logic, if you have this unfunded liability, it only gets worse. Because you're taking all the money away from it. You're cutting the blood supply off to the one program, and then you expect it to last throughout the course it's supposed to. It's nonsensical. But I truly believe that that's the plan. These people despise us. They despise working people. I can think of no other reason. If you look at the policies that they pursue, if you look at the things that they have gone after, because there are no jobs bills there. The Republican idea of a jobs bill is to lower people's wages. It's that simple. Their idea of a jobs bill is to give tax cuts to big corporations. Those aren't jobs bills. That's redistribution of wealth. That's stealing from workers, giving to the top, giving to the very wealthy. And I had this really very interesting conversation the other day with gubernatorial candidate Tom Wolf. Who is running for the Democratic running in the Democratic Party primary for the governor's to run against Corbett, and he was telling me that, you know, the thing that bothers him is that there's so much of what the Republicans say not true. It's not just, it's just not couched in the wrong terms. It's not just, it's factually untrue. It's business-wise insane. It's flat wrong. And I told him I hope he runs a campaign of pointing that out. You know, I'm telling you, I don't want another Democratic candidate who looks like Dan Honorato, who says, hey, I'm less bad than him. I want somebody who's going to stand up and say, this is how we turn this Commonwealth around. It's not through stealing wages. It's not through breaking down conditions. It's not through privatizing all of our state assets and all of our state functions. That's not the way to go. You know how you turn this Commonwealth around? You know how we create jobs here? You have a education system second to none. You have an educated workforce. You have state-of-the-art transportation. You have, because look, Pennsylvania's got great university system. That's what's saving us for now. Once they're done screwing that up, and trust me, this governor has tried, the draw is gone. I mean, the reality is if you want to have a growing economy, you need to have an educated workforce. And, you know, I just had a conversation with someone the other day, said, you know, her father came back from World War II and had worked as a butcher in a supermarket. And because of the GI Bill, got to go to college. And then went on and became a doctor, actually, and a very successful one. And she was just rattling off all these amazing things that this guy had done solely because he had the opportunity to get an education that we paid for, that the taxpayers paid for. We invested in this man. His life trajectory was that of a store clerk. But because he got that education, that investment from we the people, think of how much more in taxes and how much more in the public good that investment did. And this is what Tom Wolf was telling me. He said, you know, we've got to be investing in not only, you know, our children, but our infrastructure. We've got to be investing not tax cuts for big businesses, but infrastructure for them to get their products to market. Infrastructure where you have an education system that has a well-trained, well-educated workforce. Healthcare, where you have a healthy workforce. So many things that we're not doing. And I'm telling you right now, I can't wait for 2014 to see this governor that we've got right now ousted. And I'm hoping it's going to be by someone who didn't run on a campaign of, hey, I'm not him. You know, I want that feeling of going to the polls and pulling that lever for someone that I believe in. Someone who's going to pursue the right policies. So it'll be an interesting primary. I'm very hopeful, very, very hopeful. I'll take a quick break. I'm going to come back right after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Thought back to America. Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A U.S. steel plant in Canada could soon face its second lockout in less than 4 years. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a U.S. steel plant in Canada have rejected the company's most recent contract offer. By a vote of 70%, the workers, who are represented by the United Steelworkers, voted down the contract. The union is asking the company to come back to the bargaining table. If the company refuses, the union has the power to call a strike by the end of the week. U.S. Steel could also lock out the workers, a move the plant has been preparing for in recent weeks. They've idled a blast furnace and have trained managers and other non-union staff on how to handle production work. This wouldn't be the first time workers at the plant have faced a lockout. U.S. Steel employed the tactic in 2010, denying employees access to work for 8 months. According to the union, workers are unhappy with the number of concessions the company is seeking. Some of the concessions are related to cost of living allowances, holidays, pensions, and benefits.
Hundreds of Chicago fast food restaurant and retail workers walked off their jobs Wednesday starting at 5:30 a.m. Workers at McDonald's, Subway, Dunkin' Donuts, Macy's, Sears, and Victoria's Secrets joined the job action in Chicago. The strike was because the workers want living wages that really support families and the right to form unions without interference from employers. Victor Guzman works at a Chicago McDonald's making the state minimum wage of $8.25 an hour.
We are fighting because we have to pay food, I have to pay school, and I have to pay my bills. So $8.25 is not enough.
This worker action is part of the Fight for 15 campaign, seeking a livable wage of at least $15 an hour at fast food and retail businesses. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago says the Fight for 15 campaign is working to put more money into the pockets of 275,000 fast food and retail workers in the Chicago area. The biggest fast food workers' strike was in New York City just a few weeks ago. At a news conference in Washington Wednesday, flight attendants, including the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, continued to push back against a TSA policy of allowing small knives back on passenger planes. The unions representing flight attendants say no knives on planes ever again. The policy change has been delayed. Veda Shook, president of AFA-CWA, says her union will not stand down from the fight to keep knives off planes. She says the union is focused on a legislative path that would permanently ban knives from commercial airline passenger cabins. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIND, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show. I give my head to the new constitution. Think of five for the new revolution. Smile and green with the chains all around. Think of my guitar and bass. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. So, you know, a lot of conversations going on about what you can put on Facebook, what you can't. Can the employer fire you? Can your employer fire if you put something on there? The confidentiality things, all of this stuff now with the social media. You know, what's the balancing act? What can you do? What can't you do? We've seen cases across the country where people are fired for saying something about the company they work for. They're fired for sending emails. Well, there was an interesting decision last week that happened during the UPMC organizing campaign out in Pittsburgh, where the way I'm seeing it is the UPMC was trying to stop their workers from communicating via email about talking about organizing. And the administrative law judge has issued a decision. Here to talk to us about this is Ben Brewer. He's an assistant organizing director with SEIU Healthcare Pennsylvania. Ben, thanks for taking time for me.
You bet.
So walk me through this. What was it that got you to the point where you had to go to court?
Well, UPMC workers at hospitals in Pittsburgh have been basically made the courageous decision to build a union about a year ago for the reasons that a lot of workers form unions that win better wages, affordable health care, respect at work. And basically from day one, UPMC, which is a pretty big employer, launched a very, very aggressive anti-union campaign with everything you could imagine from captive audience meetings to pulling people in one-on-one to putting out literature. Very quickly, in our opinion, we're violating laws and seriously curtailing the rights of workers to talk about forming their union. And you know, rather than giving up, what workers said is we're going to figure this out. And part of standing up to UPMC means filing charges against UPMC to force them to respect our rights to talk about the union at work. And as a result of that, the National Labor Relations Board issued a complaint on over 80 charges against UPMC. Everything from telling workers they couldn't talk about the union to threatening workers to disciplining people unfairly, and in a couple of cases, illegally or unfairly firing workers, basically based on their union support. And as a result of that, we were able to force UPMC to settle a lot of those charges, and we won some important victories. It was really a historic victory, a number of historic victories for UPMC workers. We won the jobs of two unfairly fired workers back to work, and we got the records cleared for a bunch of people. We forced them to rewrite policies that were found to have not been okay. But there was one element of those charges that wasn't resolved in the settlement, and that had to do with this question of the use of email and social media, which is what we're talking about here tonight.
And what did the judge decide? I mean, what did the company initially do? What was it that they couldn't email at all? What was the company checking emails? Explain to me what got you to the court process.
From our perspective, it seemed pretty clear that UPMC had policies that were unfairly discriminating against workers who were interested in forming a union. That the way the policies were written is they were designed to have a chilling effect on workers who want to talk about improving their wages and working conditions. And so that's why we felt like, and workers felt like, we needed to file this with the National Labor Relations Board because the policy seemed unfair. And what the administrative law judge basically said is that it's illegal for UPMC to have policies that allow certain non-work email, for example, but prohibit union-related email, that allow certain communications via social media, but in many ways are designed to curtail communication about the union via social media.
Well, how would they know? I mean, let me ask you this. I mean, how would the employer know if I'm emailing my coworker to say, hey, you know, there's a union meeting, or hey, I saw this, can you confirm? How would my employer know that, any of that?
It's a good question. You'd probably have to ask UPMC how they monitor all that. But I think what the ALJ is saying is that the policy in and of themselves are an attempt to prevent workers from even having that conversation. That, you know, the policies are written in a way to have a chilling effect on workers and to prevent them from even getting to a place where they want to email their coworker about the union or about coming to a meeting or the wages they could win if they decided to form a union.
No, so basically just saying if you're caught emailing anything or talking, we're going to fire you because, so don't even do it, and putting that kind of that massive threat in front of it.
Yeah, I think that's what it's about, is preventing speech before it even happens, which is, I would say, one of the most powerful tactics that union busters and employers use.
And this isn't just, you know, something that UPMC thought up of themselves. I mean, this is something that goes out across this country because of the fractured nature of our labor laws and the fact that they haven't been updated in at least a couple of generations.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things to understand about this decision. I mean, to be clear, what the decision says basically is that an employer can't discriminate. They can't allow certain non-work communications, but then prohibit others. The ALJ didn't go so far as to affirm workers' right to use email to communicate about the union freely. That's still not necessarily the case. What it says is the employer can't discriminate. The ALJ did not say workers have the right to talk, to use work email to communicate about the union. And to your point, it really speaks to a larger need to update labor laws in this country to reflect the contemporary economy. The truth is a lot of these laws were written decades, if not more, ago, and the ways that workers communicate with each other are different. And I would say, and I think a lot of people would agree, that email is the modern-day water cooler.
Yeah, I agree.
And it's about time that we rewrite the laws to reflect those changes in the way that workers communicate.
Yeah, I mean, and for me, you know, this whole idea that I keep telling folks that, you know, once you punch that clock, once you step across that threshold onto the employer's property, you no longer have rights. You're basically their property, and they can spy on your email. They can monitor everything you do on their computers. So, you know, a lot of this stuff I think has to be updated, to look at different ways of the way that we communicate, but also a little bit more privacy for employees as well.
Definitely. Yeah, and the truth is we know that every day, and we see it every day, there are plenty of non-work emails that are bounced about within any given employer, you know, from jokes to get well cards, any sort of thing like that, which is frankly fine. The problem is when an employer says, we're going to turn a blind eye to a little bit of a racy joke, we're not going to bother with that. But when a worker sends an email to a friend saying, hey, you should come to this union meeting, we're going to make some changes at our hospital, then they crack down. And I think what this, what the ALJ is saying is that's simply not okay.
Yeah, good point. Well, you know, let me ask you about UPMC in general, because I thought, you know, they're one of these companies that they're one of these organizations in business solely as a public charity. This is a not-for-profit institution for the benefit of the community. And I look at this and I say, okay, you're using all of this money that should be benefiting the community by doing all of the, doing just about anything else, but beating up on workers and from stories I've heard, surveillance and harassment and intimidation and all of this. Is there any way of saying, hey, you know, you've got a certain mission that you're not upholding here?
Absolutely. And in fact, the mayor of Pittsburgh just did that, and we're very excited about it. People around this city are, I think, congratulating him and cheering him on. But the mayor of Pittsburgh, Luke Ravenstahl, very recently challenged UPMC's charity status. And he basically said, look, you as an institution, you know, provide important services to this community, are an important employer, well regarded as being a provider of very high quality care that people seek from, frankly, around the world. But you're not living up to your responsibility as a charity, and you fail on a number of fronts. And it's not. And what you mentioned, the fact that they're using our public dollars to fight workers and to violate their rights, is one pretty compelling example. But it's not the only one. I mean, this is an institution that has pretty explicitly tried to get a divorce from Highmark, which is the largest insurer in Western Pennsylvania. You know, they basically threatened to lock out millions of Highmark subscribers from the largest provider network in Western Pennsylvania simply because they want to build a bigger and bigger monopoly. You know, it's an institution that closed a hospital in Braddock, Pennsylvania, only to open one, which is a relatively working-class community with many people of color, only to open a hospital in a relatively affluent and white suburb right across the street from an existing hospital. You know, they're not only closing Braddock, but they're opening hospitals overseas. And so I think there's a general feeling among people in Pittsburgh, not just workers, but people in, you know, across the city, that UPMC is not living up to its responsibility as a charity. When you have $10 billion of revenue, hundreds of millions of dollars of profit, your CEO is the highest paid hospital CEO, nonprofit CEO in the country, yet we have infant mortality rates in the black community that are among the highest in the country. It's just something is not working. And what the mayor said is, you know, we think you're an important institution, but you need to have a real conversation with stakeholders in this city about what a responsibility from a charity really means.
Yeah, and for me, a medical establishment, something like that, is for the common good. For me, the idea of having this this organization, this hospital, and this network of hospitals is for the common good. And when you take something out of a community, it harms that community irreparably. And this idea that you're going to put it somewhere else to me, it goes against all ideals of public policy and of public service. And personally, it goes to, hey, where can I make the most money and pocket the rest?
There's no question. And when you talk about these hospitals like Braddock, the truth is many of these hospitals, well, they were built by Pittsburghers and in particular by union members. And many of these hospitals were built with the contributions and the healthcare dollars of union members who happen to have insurance. And so when they close a facility like that, they really are doing a disservice, not just to the people who depend on those services, but to all the people whose health insurance dollars, whose tax dollars went to support those institutions. But to your point about putting profit before patient care, I mean, one of the most egregious examples is UPMC has now said that people who have community blue insurance, which is a type of Highmark insurance, are not allowed to receive treatment from a UPMC facility, even if they're willing to pay out of their own pocket.
How can they do that?
Actually, a pretty good question. It's not entirely clear how they can do that. But I think the reason they do is clear, which is that there's a consistent desire to put profits and extreme profits over the needs of people in this community, whether it's workers, patients, or anyone else.
Because I keep hearing my Republican friends saying, Rick, we don't need any Obamacare because we've got national health care. If you're sick, you just go to the hospital. You just go to UPMC and they'll take care of you.
Yeah, I mean, that would be nice if that were the case. But again, if you look at indicators in this community, particularly among the African-American community, we have infant mortality rates, child asthma rates that are through the roof. And it's really hard to understand how people in Pittsburgh live in the shadow of what really is a tremendous healthcare institution. It is a global health enterprise, as UPMC says, yet can't get access to basic health care. And increasingly what happens is community clinics and free clinics are asked to shoulder the brunt of the health care needs, when UPMC could be doing so much more to serve the needs of these communities and, frankly, partnering with community health clinics, workers, and others to make sure that we really make this a healthy community.
Let me ask you a last line of questions. This decision, while I think a very good one, still hasn't gotten to the bottom line. Where are we with organizing these workers and giving them a voice on the job and a decent wage and better conditions and better benefits? Where are we with this?
It's a really good question. I mean, where we are is where we've continued to be, which is that there's no question that workers at UPMC want to make change, that when you make $10 an hour after, you know, years on the job, when you have to work two jobs or three jobs to get by, when you are indebted to your own employer through healthcare bills, something has to change. And it's always been clear that UPMC workers want to form a union, want to build the middle class in this city in the same way that the steel workers did. But UPMC has very, very aggressively worked very, very hard to stop that and have made clear that they have no problem breaking the law to do it. As a couple of examples, within the historic settlement that we won, part of what we accomplished, what workers accomplished, was forcing UPMC to rehire two people. One of them is named Ron Oates. 3 weeks after Ron won his job back, UPMC fired him again. Just 3 weeks after we walked him back to work, UPMC fired him again. There was a group of workers in the cafeteria, Presbyterian Hospital. UPMC called 911 on those workers for talking about the union on their lunch break.
Really?
So what we're at is that UPMC is so aggressively trying to stop workers that it's frankly very difficult for workers to move forward until UPMC gets out of the way. And I think what these charges are about is saying that that UPMC workers deserve the right to a free and fair election. And there's no way for workers to be able to voice their desire to form a union until UPMC agrees to get out of the way. Stop the campaigning, stop the misinformation, and certainly stop the suspensions and firings and intimidation that they've been doing.
And again, you look at this and, you know, it seems like nothing new. And to me, this is why we need a comprehensive labor law reform. And more importantly, we need a society. We need a nation of citizens and workers to say we've had enough of this kind of treatment of workers. And we need to be pushing for better policy. Ben Brewer, I appreciate the time. I wish you nothing but the best of luck there. Congratulations on the decision. Keep up the fight.
Thanks. Have a good night.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to psecu.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Factory farms are not farms at all. They are corporate-run concentration camps for pigs, cows, chickens, turkeys, and other food animals. Held in corporate confinement, these creatures of nature are denied any contact with their natural world. Instead, being crammed by the thousands into concrete and metal buildings where they are locked in torturously tiny cages for the duration of their so-called life, which is nasty, brutish, and short. All so food giants like Tyson, Smithfield, and Borden can grab fatter and quicker profits. It's so disgusting that America's consumers would gag at the sight of it. That's why the profiteers are desperate to keep you from knowing what goes on inside their factories. Nonetheless, word has been getting out as animal rights advocates, consumer groups, unions, and others have exposed some of the disgusting realities of animal confinement to the public, including showing wretch-inducing photos and videos. Rather than cleaning up their act, however, the industrial food powers have simply doubled down on disgusting. Their lobbyists have been swarming state legislatures to demand passage of laws that single out anyone who reveals the industry's ugly secrets, summarily stripping such whistleblowers of their constitutional right of free speech. This is Jim Hightower saying, the only thing that will gag you worse than viewing the gross animal abuse taking place in these factories is to look at the grossly repressive and aptly named ag gag bills moving through the legislative sausage mills of various states. The bills are ridiculous, but so are some legislatures, where corporate money trumps both common sense and the Constitution. Six states have passed ag gag laws, and six more are moving towards passage. To see what's happening in your state, go to www.humanesociety.org. That's humanesociety.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
And you know, the sandwich comes at you, touch this, touch this, touch this, go pay the cashier, there's your sandwich. It's amazing.
Ho, 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 it's magic.
It's amazing how things happen. For instance, today, nearly 300 members of the American Hotel and Lodging Association, well, they met with about 200 House and Senate offices. Why? Well, they're not happy with the Screwquester. They're not happy because massive delays, massive flight cancellations. In fact, on Monday, there were 1,200 flights delayed because of staffing problems. On Tuesday, well over 1,000 delays because of staffing problems. Yesterday, nearly 900 because of staffing problems. And, you know, for me, as it's going down, what it's telling me is people going, wow, I don't want to wait in line. I'm going to find another mode, or I'm just not going to go. Well, the good folks at the American Hotel and Lodging Association, they went to Congress, and they brought their checkbooks, I'm sure, and said, fix it. Fix it. We need people in our hotels. We need backsides in the seats, so to speak. Well, it's done. Congress, evidently the Senate anyway, the Senate unanimously approved a piece of legislation that's going to allow the Federal Aviation Administration to move $253 million from some other accounts that they have to do away with the furloughs, to eliminate the furloughs. They will not be closing the 149 towers at the smaller airports. The House probably going to take it up tomorrow. So this is breakneck speed. There's some agreement. Hey, business. Got to be more business friendly. Now, understand the FAA's got to come up with about $637 million in cuts. They say savings. It's cuts. They're going to cut $637 million from their budget by September 30th. $220 million of it from people's salaries. Those are the furloughs. $25 million of it would have come from closing the towers, and the rest. And this is what blows my mind. The rest of the money that they would take out would be from training, because why would we want training? And then travel and information technology needs. You know, computer stuff. Oh, wait a minute. How are air traffic controller, how are the towers operated? Oh, yeah, computer stuff. So we're gutting training and we're gutting the technology. Gee, I wonder what the recipe that would be. Not a good one. And it's amazing to me that, you know, Senate unanimously, because the checkbook spoke and people were upset and the wealthy said, hey, we need that business. And as we talked last night with the guy from the FAA, the corporate jets, they don't get to fly like they used to. And that probably ticked off some of the CEO class who said, hey, what's this nonsense? And it brings up the idea that, you know, some of the things that I've been thinking about, you know, I was waiting for this moment because when he said that, you know, the private planes would be the ones that would have second treatment. They wouldn't get the preferential treatment that they get at these small airports since they're going to be closing them because of the towers and everything. I said, you know, this wasn't going to take long. And I gave Obama credit for saying, well, you've got to do it all. You can't just do it piecemeal. You can't pick and choose. Look, you're the one who chose this across-the-board cut. You're the one who chose the hatchet job. Live with it. So I gave him a little bit of credit for that. But here we are. Everybody's going, uh-oh, we better piecemeal this. And I guess when the wealth class speaks, they listen. The wealth class is the new E.F. Hutton, I guess. Anyway, a study has been conducted by Benjamin Page and Jason Seawright at Northwestern University and a guy named Larry Bartels from Vanderbilt University. And the idea was to, you know, find out what the wealth class, what they think, to some basic ideas, some basic economic policy, you know, the direction of the country. And they, you know, did this survey of the very wealthy. And they found some interesting things, like 73% of the wealthy agreed that the government should run a deficit if necessary when the country's in a recession or in a time of war. Now, the right wing and the wealth class has done such a masterful job of brainwashing us that we think, oh no, debts are bad. Oh God, no, can't spend. No, spending bad, broke. 73% of the wealthy thinks, you know, hey, we've got to invest, got to get the prime the pump, get the economy, get it moving. Only 31% of the general public agreed. 65% of the very wealthy said they'd be willing to pay more in taxes to reduce the federal budget deficits. 4 in 10 of us thought it was a good idea to raise taxes on wealthy people. So you've got 65% of the wealthy going, hey, we got the money. We've got to pay the debt down. Seems logical to us. That's what we would do. But hey, thanks, working people. I'm glad the propaganda is working. They also found that a pretty similar proportion of the wealthy and the general public agreed that the difference in income, that wealth distribution problem that we have, that gap between those who have, 62% of the wealthy believe that the gap is too large. 63% of the general public believe too large. The general public believes our government should redistribute wealth by heavy taxes on the rich, yet 17% of the wealthy believe that. And, you know, you go back to that first one where we should run deficits. Well, who's going to pay for that? Should raise taxes on the wealthy when we need to reduce deficits? It's kind of interesting that, you know, at the end of it, they, well, kind of backpedaled. But I was reading through this study. And it blew my, there were a couple of things that just jumped right off the page at me. And they asked the question, you know, what do you think the problems are? What's a very important problem in the wealth class's world? And 87% of them said budgets. You know, the budget deficit, that's a big problem. 84% said unemployment, 79% said education, 74% international terrorism, 70% energy. Healthcare was up there, child poverty, trade deficits way down there, inflation way down there. Inflation, 26% of the wealthy were worried about inflation. Only 16 gave a rat's behind about climate change because they're going to be kind of unaffected by it. But you know what I found interesting? You didn't see gay marriage on the list. You didn't see abortion on the list. You didn't see that stuff on there because they don't care. They care about money. They're the wealthy. They don't care about all that stuff that they use to divide us with. I also found it interesting their spending priorities. They were more willing to invest in infrastructure, highways, bridges, airports, than the general public. They were much more, almost more than double, more interested in investing in scientific research. Less likely to invest in paying for education, wanted education, just didn't want to pay for it. Jobs programs, they wanted nothing to do with it. Environmental protection wanted nothing to do with it. Homeland Security could care less. They don't want to pay for it. Healthcare, negative 19, wanted nothing to do with it. Food stamps, nothing to do with it. Social Security, nothing to do with it. All of those things that we use, nothing to do with it. And on some very interesting other questions, the idea of a safety net under our feet. One of the questions that was asked in the survey is, should government be the one that makes sure that, you know, people have food to eat, a place, a shelter over their head, clothes on their back, you know, all that Christian nation stuff that we like to tell ourselves? 43% of the wealthy said, yeah, it's something that's very important. 68% of the general public. So there's a huge divide there. On the minimum wage issue, the idea of having a minimum wage that someone who works for a full time, 40 hours a week, that they should be above the minimum, above the poverty line. Only 40% of our wealth class, that should be the case. 78% of the working people, because sadly a lot of people are working for minimum wage and well below the poverty line. Also, the question of should government provide a decent standard of living for the unemployed? Should there be decent unemployment benefits? Should it be enough to sustain while you look for other employment? Only 23% of the wealth class said we should have sustainable unemployment when you have 50% of the general public who believe, yeah, we should. Personally, I think that 50% should be closer to 80 or 90, but, you know, a lot of propaganda money's gone into this. Also, the question of should government see that everyone who wants a job gets one. 68% of the general public said, yeah, they should be employer of last resort. Something I've talked about quite often, and I think we should do away with the handout programs, do away with the welfare, do away with all of that stuff, and have jobs programs. Well, only 19% of the wealth class believe that government should be the employer of last resort. Also, one of my other favorite ones, the earned income tax credit, a very Republican idea signed into law by Ronald Reagan, dreamt up by Milton Friedman himself. Only 13% of the wealth class thought it should be increased, as the whole of the populace, 49%, said it should be increased. And the final one was, you know, the federal government should provide jobs for everyone able and willing to work who can't find one in the private sector. Only 8% believed in that, while 53% of the general populace thought, you know what, we should have government as employer of the last resort. I agree. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Earth. Sky. Thursday, April 25th. At CNN, the Earth's eastern hemisphere, the full moon barely clips the Earth's dark umbral shadow for 27 minutes tonight, to present one of the shortest partial eclipses in the 21st century. At the greatest eclipse, the Earth's dark shadow will cover less than 1.5% of the moon's diameter.
From most of Europe and Western Africa, the moon will be partially eclipsed shortly after sunset tonight. As viewed from the Middle East and Western Asia, the partial eclipse will take place at late night or around midnight. And if you live in Australia, Indonesia, or Eastern Asia, the lunar eclipse will happen before sunrise tomorrow. Come to our website at earthsky.org to find out the precise times of tonight's partial lunar eclipse for your part of the world.
A lunar eclipse can only happen at full moon, or when the moon lies opposite the sun in Earth's sky. When Earth sits directly between the moon and sun, then the Earth's dark shadow totally covers the lunar disk. However, the alignment is a little off this time around, so it's only an exceedingly shallow partial lunar eclipse tonight. But the moon won't swing through the Earth's dark umbral shadow again until the total lunar eclipse of April 15, 2014.
People in the world's eastern hemisphere can watch tonight's partial eclipse of the full moon. And those missing the eclipse will still see a full-looking moon near the golden planet Saturn from dusk till dawn. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
I'm on a Mexican radio. I'm on a Mexican
1-888-520 Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Saw an interesting story over at USA Today that caught my attention. It's one of the, to me, it's a workers' issue. And while we're talking about the big news today is who's going in the NFL draft, who went first, what teams filling what needs, there was a story there about Brad Johnson. And you may remember Brad Johnson. He won a Super Bowl, I think it was with Tampa Bay, a number of years back. Was a quarterback. I guess he was like 15, 16 years he was in the league. Actually 17 years he was there. And, you know, retired in 2008, you know, after a long career, taking numerous hits. And now, you know, all of the injuries have piled onto him. In fact, the story goes on to say that he qualified for the insurance program that the disability insurance program that the NFL has. I'm sure it's not an awful lot of money, but you know, this line of duty disability payments that they give out because look, he's disabled. And the story goes into, you know, his 73-year-old father walks better than he does and how, you know, there are knee replacements down the line and, you know, the money that they give him from these payments, I guess $5,200 he'll get towards a knee replacement, which last time I checked, they were like 25 grand, but, you know, it goes into this whole question, you know. These guys' lives, these guys' careers. Broken, beaten. To me, these guys are workers, like anybody else. And what the underlying theme of the story was about, it was a workers' comp story. You know, these are employees whose bodies are beaten and broken, who are never going to be able to work again. They're going to have numerous surgeries. They're going to need numerous medications for the rest of their lives. And, you know, he was telling the story about for the last several years of his career. He couldn't get through a game without being shot up with some painkiller, this Toradol, starting in 2002. So for 6 years, every game shot with these painkillers. And, in fact, there's a lawsuit filed you know, I guess back in 2011, where you have all these NFL players who saying, look, you had these teams who were shooting us up every game, you know, just to get out there. So, we, you know, got to win, got to play. Because if you don't, the guy behind you is going to come and take your job. And I look at this and I go, you know, there's something seriously wrong with this. You know, as someone who has had injuries in the past, and, you know, look, I never took any of these painkillers or these shots solely because I want to know what's coming. I want to know your pain is there for a reason. It tells you something is wrong. And, you know, they've masked it. And now you've got these guys who are, you know, they're done. And part of the article was talking about, you know, hey, these players need some they need some lifetime health care because they're not going to, most of them aren't going to get jobs doing anything else because their bodies are beaten and broken, and most of them aren't going to have money that they're going to live on for the rest of their lives. So there needs to be something to help them. And there are only some 18,000 former players, and they're saying, look, you know, there should be something to help. With all of the billions that go into this, there should be something. And you may remember a couple of years ago, there was a whole argument about workers' compensation. And in fact, I think it was the New Orleans Saints. If I remember right, it was the Saints who made a big stink. The Saints owner made a huge stink about players filing for unemployment compensation in California, because California has one of the most generous systems in the country. If you've done any work in California, and you can claim an injury. And it's one of those things where whether you were directly injured there or not, you can still claim there. And, you know, I look at this and, you know, the New Orleans Saints, as I remember, negotiated into all of their players' contracts a stipulation that they could not, under matter of contract, could not file a workers' compensation claim in California. It had to be done in Louisiana. So even if you were playing the Chargers that weekend and blew out both knees, you had to file the claim in Louisiana. Because before California said that they were going to open it up for everybody, as long as you did business within the state, you had to do it within the state that you were living, where the company was, the NFL team, obviously. And I find it interesting that, you know, you've got the Arena Football League, who doesn't have a team in California solely for that reason. That's it. They want to screw their workers. And, you know, here again, to me, these are the kind of questions that I ask quite often. You know, what do you do with these folks? And, you know, I've had people in the past say, well, you know, these guys, they know what they're getting into, and they know that their bodies are going to get beaten and broken, and then what's their choice? Liberty of contract. And we hear this crap all the time, don't we? Shouldn't it be more about how do we make the game safer? Shouldn't it be more about, you know, how do we make sure that these guys don't get broken and beaten? And I know it's some of it's part of the game, but you look at these concussions, you look at, you know, the chronic injuries that we just mask with drugs. Something wrong with it. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Also, Stitcher, get the podcast there. Take it on your smartphone, wherever you go. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
A U.S. steel plant in Canada could soon face its second lockout in less than 4 years. Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a U.S. steel plant in Canada have rejected the company's most recent contract offer. By a vote of 70%, the workers, who are represented by the United Steelworkers, voted down the contract. The union is asking the company to come back to the bargaining table. If the company refuses, the union has the power to call a strike by the end of the week. U.S. Steel could also lock out the workers, a move the plant has been preparing for in recent weeks. They've idled a blast furnace and have trained managers and other non-union staff on how to handle production work. This wouldn't be the first time workers at the plant have faced a lockout. U.S. Steel employed the tactic in 2010, denying employees access to work for 8 months. According to the union, workers are unhappy with the number of concessions the company is seeking. Some of the concessions are related to cost of living allowances, holidays, pensions, and benefits.
Hundreds of Chicago fast food restaurant and retail workers walked off their jobs Wednesday starting at 5:30 a.m. Workers at McDonald's, Subway, Dunkin' Donuts, Macy's, Sears, and Victoria's Secrets joined the job action in Chicago. The strike was because the workers want living wages that really support families and the right to form unions without interference from employers. Victor Guzman works at a Chicago McDonald's making the state minimum wage of $8.25 an hour.
We are fighting because we have to pay food, I have to pay school, and I have to pay my bills. So $8.25 is not enough.
This worker action is part of the Fight for 15 campaign, seeking a livable wage of at least $15 an hour at fast food and retail businesses. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago says the Fight for 15 campaign is working to put more money into the pockets of 275,000 fast food and retail workers in the Chicago area. The biggest fast food workers' strike was in New York City just a few weeks ago. At a news conference in Washington Wednesday, flight attendants, including the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, continued to push back against a TSA policy of allowing small knives back on passenger planes. The unions representing flight attendants say no knives on planes ever again. The policy change has been delayed. Veda Shook, president of AFA-CWA, says her union will not stand down from the fight to keep knives off planes. She says the union is focused on a legislative path that would permanently ban knives from commercial airline passenger cabins. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Our quote of the day comes from Karen Heller in her piece over at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She writes, 2 years ago, Stanford's Center for Research on Education Outcomes found that students at Pennsylvania's then eight cyber schools performed significantly worse on reading and math than peers in the traditional public schools. She writes, last year, not one state cyber charter, then totaling a dozen, met federal academic standards. Not one, she writes. She says, today, Pennsylvania has 16 cyber charter schools. She says, in the strange math of charter schools, it is possible to be fruitless and multiply, because not one has met. And yet we keep growing them because we have this blind allegiance. It's the same thing with this insane testing that keeps going on. And I just saw just minutes ago that the Chicago Public School is suspending their Northwest Evaluation Association's measure of academic progress for primary grades for kindergarten, first, and second grade students. And for me, I go, really? You've got a standardized test for kindergartners? Something seriously, seriously wrong. And we've really got to be changing the conversation, especially with regards to public education, because I see the attack. There are folks who believe that the gold rush is on and education is the gold, which is why I asked Ellen Weiss, she's national coordinator for the Broader Approach to Education campaign. Boldapproach.org is their website, to come talk to us about the race to the top's unfulfilled promises. Elaine, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I look at this report that you guys just put out, Market-Oriented Education Reform Rhetoric, Trump's Reality, and I don't know that I could come up with a better title for it, because we keep hearing all of this rhetoric. Oh, it's wonderful. It's fantastic. It's great. It's the savior. It's the next latest, greatest thing. Yet, you know, as I keep seeing, failure, 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 and lost money, tons of it.
Well, some people are losing money and some people are not, right?
Well, that's a good point. Lost money from my kids' education, lost opportunities for the children, especially of this Commonwealth and across the country. So, point well taken. So, what did you find in this report?
So, what we found in this report, frankly, even surprised us. And I'll be very honest. I mean, we were not only skeptical, we went into this, you know, quite hostile you know, to these reforms. And I want to be specific that we were talking about, you know, three specific reforms that we feel comprise this kind of package that's really being promoted and adopted across the country, specifically heavy reliance on test scores to evaluate not only teachers but entire schools, closing schools that are either so-called failing or deemed under-enrolled, and increasing access to charter under the guise that this gives parents and students more choice. And, you know, we also heard a lot of rhetoric, and our sense was that the rhetoric probably didn't quite the reality probably didn't quite match up. But I'll be very frank, we were very surprised at how bad the results were. Oh. I mean, when we looked, we said, wow, this is actually worse than we expected. Across the board, we really saw two things. And I'll explain also, we weren't looking race to the top at this point. Race to the top is fairly new. We wanted to look at places where these basically cities that had kind of spurred race to the top, that were the birthplaces for race to the top. So New York City and Chicago, where this package of reforms had already been in place for a decade, more or less, and Washington, D.C., where they are now going into their fifth year, or I guess almost going into their sixth year, but where maybe they've been more prominent than anywhere else because of Michelle Rhee and how vocal she's been. So we felt like these were the right cities to study. These reforms had been in place long enough that we would get a good sense of how well they had done or not done. But the big advantage we had also was that these cities all have reliable test scores, NAEP scores. And so we could really compare them against one another. And more importantly, we could compare them against other cities, other big urban high poverty districts. And what we saw was that across the board, they performed really badly. By and large, the test scores in these cities were lower in almost all cases than they were in New York City, universally so.
How's that possible?
Than in these comparable other districts. And that in many cases, not in every case, but in many cases, they also were growing achievement gaps, in particular race achievement gaps, but also income-based ones, at the same time that race-based gaps were closing in other cities. And this was because whatever gains were seen in these cities, which again were much smaller than those seen in the average large district, were accruing very heavily not to the minority kids and the low-income students that these reforms promised to help, but to the other kids, to the white kids and the richer kids.
How's that possible? I mean, I keep hearing, you know, things are so wonderful in New York. Mayor Bloomberg's turned it around. Michelle Rhee single-handedly whipped that school district into...
I live near Washington, D.C. Believe me, you think you've heard it loudly. You haven't heard it as loudly as I have.
I mean, you turn on the radio and you hear all these wonderful things. And you hear all of this propaganda and the news media keeps pumping it out that everything's changing. It's going to be wonderful when we finally privatize everything. Yet,
well, one of
saying,
the reasons, and we talk about this in the report, and the reason we say rhetoric is because in each of these cities, the leaders were vocally going around claiming this. And basically, they could do it because they could use their state test scores to make these claims. So, for example, in New York City and Chicago, what they basically did was just recalibrate test scores to change what counted as proficient, which, of course, means you could count anyone as proficient. Now, they didn't count everyone. But what they did was just change what it meant to do well on the test score. And, of course, all of a sudden, lots more kids were doing well. When those test scores were switched back to mean what they were supposed to mean, all of a sudden, of course, most of those kids were not proficient anymore, just like they hadn't been to begin with. But as you know, as most of us know, once something has been declared so vocally and so repeatedly, I sat in on a forum in which Mayor Bloomberg claimed to have cut in half the race-based test score, the race-based achievement gap in New York City in the course of 6 years. It wouldn't even have been possible. I mean, it didn't matter how successful anything he did would have been. And when it turned out, when gaps were assessed across the board appropriately and skeptically, he had closed the gap not by 50%, but by 1%.
Well, I still closed the gap, right?
Exactly. Unless you use NAEP scores, in which case they had slightly widened.
But here again, you know, it's as a parent, you want to believe this. And, you know, recently I opted my daughter out of the state. She's a fifth grader, and she's, I'll give you the reason. You know, I come home and I hear my daughter playing with my seven-year-old son, my four-year-old daughter. They're playing school, and she's telling the two younger siblings that they'd better pay attention and they'd better do well on the PSSAs or they're going to take the money away and the school's going to close. She's play teaching to the test. And I finally said, that's enough of this. This is ridiculous. And then you find out that they don't get the results, well, till next year. So there's no real assessment going on that's going to help her today, because we all want to believe these tests are diagnostic and we're going to help and you're going to learn what the kids didn't know and help them learn and all of this stuff. These tests are nothing more than gathering data for the sole purpose of closing schools.
No, absolutely they're not. And the truth is, you know, it's interesting because we had our superintendent, Montgomery County, Maryland Superintendent Joshua Starr, who, as I said, has called for a 3-year moratorium. And he said, look, I think tests can be very important. If you have really good tests and you use them for the right purposes and you support your teachers to use them for the right purposes and you do not misuse them, they can be fabulous. And he's absolutely right. And he said, and we're not doing that. And he said, you know, this is what we're doing right now is a waste of time.
And
you
money.
Know, I hire, support, develop, and nurture great teachers who are really good at using data the right way. And he does. I mean, my kids are in those schools, and I see it every day. And those teachers are really good at figuring out what these kids do and don't know in a timely manner, in a holistic manner, not just looking at, you know, shallow bits of their knowledge here and there, but across the board. How are they developing as students? How are they developing as people?
See, I'm not a guy, and I told my, when I sat down and I talked to my daughter, I said, look, I'm not going to let you take these tests, but understand, I'm not against tests. I'm against these tests. I believe the tests are used, as you've pointed out, used properly, are a good thing to help you learn what it is you don't know and what you need to work on. And we had this very long conversation, and she understood. The school district, you know, surprisingly, didn't fight.
I had the same experience with my daughter, by the way, because my daughter's been listening to me get on radio shows and, you know, kind of eat, drink, sleep, and breathe this report for the last 6 months. And she asked, what are you talking about? And when I explained to her, first of all, she got very nervous. She said, Mommy, I heard that, you know, how I do on this test, my teacher's going to be effective. And I said, you know, we're very lucky. We live in a place where your superintendent doesn't allow that because he knows better than that. We're very lucky. And no. And I asked her, I said, really, honestly, she has a fabulous teacher. This is my almost 9-year-old. I said, we know we love your teacher. Do you think that if you do really well on the test, it's mostly because your teacher is great? And she thought about it, and she said, probably not. And I said, let me ask you another question. If you didn't do well on this test, do you think it would be mostly because your teacher did a bad job? And she said, no, definitely not.
So,
and I said, what do you think matters? And she said, well, I read all the time, and you read to me. And we go to museums, and we travel. And my friends do these things, and I'm in a book club. And she went on and on and on. And I said, you know, your teacher is very important. And she said, right, and these other things are really important too. And I said, exactly.
Yeah, and you look at the schools that they've labeled as quote-unquote failing, you got to wonder how many of those quote-unquote failing schools that the children there have those kind of opportunities that you laid out.
Well, and my 8-year-old daughter pointed that out to me. I you know, when I told her that in Chicago, not only do they want to judge teachers by this, but they'll judge an entire school. And if too many students score low on a test, they'll close the school. First of all, she didn't believe me. She told me that I was crazy. Then when I told her, no, I'm sorry, they really do that, she said, that's so stupid. And yeah. I said, no kidding. And I said, what do you think they should do? And she said, well, I guess if I were in charge, I would try to figure out why are students not scoring well, as well on their tests as other people. And then I would figure out what it is that they need that they're not getting and try to get them more of it. And try to figure out what's not going well in the school and stop them from doing that.
Did she apply for Arne Duncan's job?
And I stopped her from saying that she was smarter than the people in charge of the Chicago Public School.
Well, not just Chicago. You don't have to go that far. You come right here to Pennsylvania because we've got the test-based evaluations coming on board next year for the teachers in our Commonwealth. So it's not as far away as you think.
No. No, no, look, this, and going back to, you know, asking, I mean, the reason we felt this report was so important was because really these three cities at the time were more or less pioneers in terms of how comprehensively they adopted this agenda and they implemented it. But now, far from being, now they're the norm. I mean, now this is not, you know, the idea that this is even reform is kind of crazy. I mean, as we point out, this is the new status quo for education policy. And the idea that we are going down a path that not only isn't helpful, but is actively harmful and most harmful to the very students that it's purporting to help is obscene.
I absolutely agree. And
we need to call this out. And we felt like no matter how angry it makes people to hear this, and it will be very frustrating. And I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist. I believe firmly that many of the people doing this, including the Secretary of Education, really believe that this will help those kids. I do. I think he believed that in Chicago, and I think I'm positive he believes it now. I do not say this, that most of these people have ill intent. Some of them maybe.
But not listening
and not seeing what's going on and not listening to parents who are traumatized and not listening to students who are traumatized and not paying attention when kids get shoveled from one school to another, sometimes multiple times, is just unacceptable.
Well, I mean, it sounds plausible. It sounds, I'm a parent. I talk to parents all the time. We all want what's best for our kids. We all want to make sure that they're getting the best education possible. And what all of the quote unquote experts are telling us is this is it. All of this, we need to test them. We need to know what they know and we need to do all of these things. Yet it's not working. And, the numbers bear that out. It's just not working. Some charter schools are doing well. The majority of them, they're not. They're either doing the same or worse. The cyber charters, forget it.
Right. Well, that's another one of those where I feel like if you took a step back and asked yourself, would it really make sense to put a seven-year-old in front of a computer with no teacher and think that that's going to – I mean, anything could work well for an exceptional child, a child who has very, very specific different needs or certain circumstances.
Yep.
But in general, I think logic would tell most people that that doesn't make sense.
What surprises me, Elaine, is that the cyber charter students don't do much better than everybody else. And I'll tell you why. Back on School Choice Appreciation Day or Appreciation Week, where they were sending out pictures of themselves with I Want Choice, there was a kid that tweeted out a picture of himself sitting in front of two computer screens. Obviously, one he was doing his schoolwork on, and the other one, I would surmise he was cheating on. I got to be honest. There's part of me that goes, I'm surprised that they're not doing better because of the opportunity to, well, cheat.
I mean.
You have nowhere to go with that, do you?
There's plenty of cheating going on, but it does not seem to be mainly taking place. Like, students are not doing it.
Look at Atlanta. Yeah, look at Atlanta. So last question I've got for you. What do we do? What do parents do? What's the answer to all of this?
Well, I think, in Philadelphia and in Chicago, increasingly in New York, I hope soon in Washington, D.C., I think parents are doing great things. I think parents are speaking out as much as they can. I think they are really making their voices heard. I think they are joining forces with teachers. And I think they're pointing out, you used the term education experts earlier, as if the people who are putting these policies in place are education experts. And by and large, they're not. And that is a big part of the problem. Our perception, our understanding of who is an education expert has really strayed pretty badly. Our failure to trust the people who work in classrooms every day, who teach, who run schools, who learn in classrooms and their parents, those are really education experts, and we need to be listening to them a lot more. And I think we're having really a revolution in a lot of these cities where parents have had it.
Yep.
Parents like you who are opting their kids out, parents like me who are writing these reports. This is what I see happening. And I think there's a point where the combination of fed up parents and undeniable data are going to win.
Yeah, my fear is what we've done to education is exactly what we did to healthcare. Instead of having doctors run hospitals, we've got bean counters. And the sad reality is I think instead of having educators running education, we're heading towards the day where it's the bean counters and the entrepreneurs who are looking to load their pockets and not so concerned about the public good, or at least my kid.
We haven't hit that tipping point yet, and we can still pull it the other way.
I'm with you. The report you can read over at boldapproach.org, written by Elaine Weiss. It's titled Market-Oriented Education Reform Rhetoric Trumps Reality. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Elaine Weiss's name. Elaine, I appreciate the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
You know I told you once tonight. that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Factory farms are not farms at all. They are corporate-run concentration camps for pigs, cows, chickens, turkeys, and other food animals. Held in corporate confinement, these creatures of nature are denied any contact with their natural world. Instead, being crammed by the thousands into concrete and metal buildings where they are locked in torturously tiny cages for the duration of their so-called life, which is nasty, brutish, and short. All so food giants like Tyson, Smithfield, and Borden can grab fatter and quicker profits. It's so disgusting that America's consumers would gag at the sight of it. That's why the profiteers are desperate to keep you from knowing what goes on inside their factories. Nonetheless, word has been getting out as animal rights advocates, consumer groups, unions, and others have exposed some of the disgusting realities of animal confinement to the public, including showing wretch-inducing photos and videos. Rather than cleaning up their act, however, the industrial food powers have simply doubled down on disgusting. Their lobbyists have been swarming state legislatures to demand passage of laws that single out anyone who reveals the industry's ugly secrets, summarily stripping such whistleblowers of their constitutional right of free speech. This is Jim Hightower saying, the only thing that will gag you worse than viewing the gross animal abuse taking place in these factories is to look at the grossly repressive and aptly named ag gag bills moving through the legislative sausage mills of various states. The bills are ridiculous, but so are some legislatures, where corporate money trumps both common sense and the Constitution. Six states have passed ag gag laws, and six more are moving towards passage. To see what's happening in your state, go to www.humanesociety.org. That's humanesociety.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
Fuzzy math. It's fuzzy math. Fuzzy math. I'm practicing fuzzy math. A lot of times we need to fudge the numbers and not tell the truth. For diplomacy to be effective, lies must be credible.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you got missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app, take the program on the go. Mayor Michael Nutter of Philadelphia says, well, you know, the outlook for the schools there in the city, totally grim. Totally grim. District's cash-strapped. And it's almost a generation of bad decisions, especially by the state. It's a whole bunch of defunding, especially by the Corbett administration. You're looking at all of this money that's been stripped out of it. The school district there is, well, huge deficit. I think the number I saw was $300 million deficit. They're trying to get, some $60 million from the city, trying to get $120 million from the state, and they're trying to take wages away from teachers. And it's one of those things where you go, they have run this situation so badly into the ground. They've created such a massive crisis that you go, you know, what are you waiting for? And here again, I mean, you look at the budgets of this governor, the priorities this guy's put forth. It's just mind-blowing to me. And there's the fact that all of these misadventures over the years, the whole Edison thing where they tried to privatize it there, the whole, now this whole, the charter thing where you've got these people who come in, millions of dollars in consultant fees and hundreds of millions of dollars for testing and all of this stuff. And what's going to happen? The latest school budget, they're saying no more counselors, no more librarians, no more sports, no more extracurricular activities, none of that stuff. Secretaries, teacher's aide, summer school, all gone, cut to the bone. Done. And you go, well, you know, that's just Philadelphia. For now, this is the model that's going to be replicated all across this state, all across the country, really. And the answer that they keep putting out to us, well, charter schools, they do it cheaper, right? Wrong. Same amount of money, just divided differently. Taken from the teachers, taken from the classroom, put in the hands of the consultants or the corporations that own the curriculum that you and I paid for. And the reality is these charter schools, they're not the latest, greatest thing. In fact, according to one article I read, almost a quarter of the 84 charter schools in the city of Philadelphia under some sort of investigation, either on the federal or the state level. They think this is a gold rush. They think it's the educational gold rush. And you know what the gold is? It's your money. And there's this idea that, you know, these charter schools, these are the answer. And the cyber charter ones are fantastic. Think about this. The school district's asking for $60 million from the city. The city has enrolled 6,000 kids in these cyber charter schools. You'll never guess how much money it costs to send these 6,000 kids to the cyber charter school. I guess you did. It's $60 million, the exact sum that they need from the city. So you've created this whole other animal, and you've pulled this money out of the city schools. And you've divided the pot. There's something wrong here. There's something seriously wrong. And as I said before, you've got these studies that have come out that say, you know what, these charter schools, they don't do, for the most part, any better. In fact, you know, a good number of them do worse. And the cyber charter ones, well, none of them do any better. They're all worse. But I loved the statement by the Philadelphia school superintendent, a guy named William Height. It was one of those things that just caught my attention. He said, we want to begin to compete for students. He said, we want to develop innovative school models that will provide options for many of our students who are not as successful as we want them to be in traditional comprehensive high schools. So what they do is they set up these cyber schools, like the Pittsburgh Online Academy, which launched with 144 students in it. Today, the only problem is, of the 144, you only have 47 left because, well, the first semester, nobody showed up because they don't work. But here's the reason the cyber charters are being pushed so heavily. In Philadelphia, anyway, classroom for right now, until this contract is up, until they ram this down their throat, classrooms are limited to 33 kids per teacher. The cyber charter schools, or the virtual world, well, they can have up to 125 kids per class, per teacher. Think about that. Think about the cost savings. Now, go back to what I said before. None of the cyber charter schools met average yearly progress. None of them. Not one. And now you're going to expand it, and you're going to put more response. It's insane. Absolutely, positively, without question, insane. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
10% of the people own 90% of the wealth. Where do you fit in? Take a look at yourself. 10% of the people own 90% of the wealth.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Workers in the late 1930s began exerting their recently guaranteed right to organize and join unions. Millions of workers flocked to join the labor organization of their choosing to collectively bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Factory, mill, and mine owners, not eager to embrace the changes, fought vehemently to deny workers their rights. As company tactics grew more heavy-handed and brutal, the workers' organizing methods changed. Sit-down strikes became a way for workers to demand their rights and to force management to listen. With a wave of a handkerchief, the tip of a hat, workers would shut down their machines, lay down their hammer, and sit down. Workers at the Hershey Chocolate Factory in Hershey, Pennsylvania, seeking to reduce the 60-hour-long work week, decided to form a union. Initially, an agreement was reached, but as the economy took a downturn, the company willfully violated the agreement by laying off the most senior workers, those who just happened to be the most ardent union supporters. The workers voted to strike the very next day. At 11 a.m. on April 2, 1937, a red handkerchief was waved and the workers began their first sit-down strike in Pennsylvania's history. The company reacted by forming the Loyal Workers Club. These strikebreakers consisted of hired thugs from New York City and local farmers, dairy producers, and shopkeepers who were dependent on the factory. On April 6, Hershey organized a loyalty parade. After hours of rallying speeches, the lathered-up Loyal Workers Club mob found pipes and clubs that had been manufactured at the Hershey planing mill. The angry mob headed to the Hershey factory to throw their strikers out. Songs of solidarity sung by the striking workers could be heard from inside the factory as the angry mob burst into the plant. Blocking the only exit, the Loyal Workers Club, loyal only to management and greed, began pummeling the workers as they tried to escape. The assault left numerous workers bloody and beaten, many unconscious. Within days, Hershey reopened and recognized a renamed version of the Loyal Workers Club. In May of 1938, the National Labor Relations Board ruled Hershey had violated the law and the company union was dissolved. Soon, the workers joined the Bakery and Confectionery Workers Local 464, who have faithfully represented the workers ever since. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Earth, sky.
Thursday, April 25th. As seen from the Earth's eastern hemisphere, the full moon barely clips the Earth's dark umbral shadow for 27 minutes tonight to present one of the shortest partial eclipses in the 21st century. At the greatest eclipse, the Earth's dark shadow will cover less than 1.5% of the moon's diameter.
From most of Europe and Western Africa, the moon will be partially eclipsed shortly after sunset tonight. As viewed from the Middle East and Western Asia, the partial eclipse will take place at late night or around midnight. And if you live in Australia, Indonesia, or Eastern Asia, the lunar eclipse will happen before sunrise tomorrow. Come to our website at earthsky.org to find out the precise times of tonight's partial lunar eclipse for your part of the world.
A lunar eclipse can only happen at full moon, or when the moon lies opposite the sun in Earth's sky. When Earth sits directly between the moon and sun, then the Earth's dark shadow totally covers the lunar disk. However, the alignment is a little off this time around, so it's only an exceedingly shallow partial lunar eclipse tonight. But the moon won't swing through the Earth's dark umbral shadow again until the total lunar eclipse of April 15, 2014.
People in the world's eastern hemisphere can watch tonight's partial eclipse of the full moon. And those missing the eclipse will still see a full-looking moon near the golden planet Saturn from dusk till dawn. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
A nation that relies on its miners not do everything in its power to protect them. How can we let anyone in this country put their lives at risk by simply showing up to work, by simply pursuing the American dream? We cannot bring back the 29 men we lost. They are with the Lord now. Our task here on earth is to save lives from being lost in another such tragedy. To do what we must do individually and collectively to assure safe conditions underground to treat our miners like they treat each other, like a family, because we are all family and we are all Americans.
I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. That was 3 years ago today, the Upper Big Branch mine in Beckley, West Virginia. 29 miners killed there. And, you know, you didn't hear much of that rhetoric, that discussion today as the president was in West Texas talking about the 15 people killed in that tragedy. And it's one of those things that I look at that, you know, when you see these things, you go, what could we have done differently? Should we have, maybe inspected the place once or twice? You know, what could we have done differently? Which is why I've asked Tom O'Connor, Executive Director, the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, to come talk to us. Tom, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I look at this tragedy and I go, you know, it's any time a worker goes to work and doesn't come home, it's a tragedy for the family, for the community. But I look at this and I go, you know, this is a place that hasn't been inspected in years. I saw one report 5 years. I saw one report 26 years. To me, it's this whole push towards deregulation and, well, business will police themselves. And we see these tragedies and you go, they didn't do such a good job.
Yeah. You know, I just want to go back to what you started off with, which is it was a little unfortunate that in today's the president's speech compared to that wonderful speech that you just played after the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, where the president talked about needing to have accountability for what happened there, that we needed to make some changes as a result to make sure that that didn't happen again. And today there was no mention of anything like that, and I heard comments from investigators looking at the causes of the incident, and they suggested that, well, maybe it was an act of God or it was just some unavoidable accident. But there's almost always an explanation in these catastrophic incidents for why they happened. And it often goes back to lack of oversight, as you suggested. And it's true that in the case of OSHA, they had not been into the plant since the 1980s. So it had been, you know, some 25 years since they were inspected by OSHA.
You know, I look at this, and the word accountability keeps coming up in my mind. And you look 3 years ago when the Upper Big Branch when that happened, still, I don't think enough people have been held accountable. I know a low-level foreman and somebody else has been got a couple of years, but that was a culture of cost cutting. That was a culture of corner cutting, and it was the culture I think that made that condition quite possible. And I know and I believe as this unfolds, as this investigation happens at this fertilizer plant in West Texas, that I think you're going to see that same kind of culture there as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're going to be learning more about that as the investigation continues, and we don't know too much about the details. But what we do know is that this plant was storing a very large quantity of a highly explosive chemical, which has been used by terrorists around the world in terrorist attacks, and they had, you know, something like 50 or 100 times the amount that Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City. And yet that had not been reported as it was supposed to have been to the Department of Homeland Security. They did not apparently communicate that, as far as I can tell, to the firefighters who responded tragically to the fire and apparently didn't really know what they were getting into. You know, I don't know if you've heard the audio recordings that came out of the response, but they were talking with a police officer who was standing there with the plant manager, and the police officer was saying, is there anything that they should know? And that I did not hear any communication to the effect that there was an extremely explosive chemical there and that, you know, this could turn into something much worse than a fire. So, you know, there's a lot of questions about accountability, as you suggested.
You know, for me, I look at the site of this, and the one report I saw said that there's a crater in the earth 93 feet wide, 10 feet deep because of this explosion. And I said, you know, who in their right mind I don't even know if they have zoning laws in Texas, but who thought it was a bright idea to put this kind of a facility 500 feet from an elementary school and 1,000 feet from a nursing home and 2,500 feet from a hospital? What genius thought that up?
Yeah, as I understand it, the plant was essentially grandfathered in. The plant, the town sort of grew up around the plant, and the residents came after the plant. But the fact is, it seems that there's very little in the way of zoning restrictions in Texas, and the federal law doesn't place any restrictions on the use of these extremely hazardous materials. And the presence of residents nearby. So, you know, I'm hoping that at least that this incident will be a wake-up call to make people think a little more about what does that mean to have these extremely hazardous materials in residential communities.
All across the country, because here's the reality. And the one report I read said, you know, for OSHA to inspect every facility in this country, it would take 111 years or some obscene time frame like that for the inspectors to go to every job site. And you got to wonder how many of these fertilizer plants and how many of these kind of plants are out there that we don't know about. They're just behind a fence. They're behind a wall. And I saw a story that said that the Texas state government wasn't going to release where the other fertilizer plants are. So we may not know that there may be 10, 20, 50 more of these places like the one in West Texas.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. And, you know, I also want to just remember that we are focusing on this incident because it was a terrible, catastrophic disaster. It was a tragedy. 15 people killed, you know, 10 firefighters. It was the worst firefighter loss since 9/11 in any single incident. A terrible tragedy. But we should also remember that workers are killed on the job every day in this country in what we think of as just routine incidents. And you know, and that same number of people that died in that incident approximately is what die every day on the job in this country from very preventable causes. And unfortunately, we don't have an OSHA that has the resources to get out there to the workplaces and inspect the workplaces around the country and make sure that workers truly have the right to a safe and healthy workplace. And as you said, OSHA is so understaffed. It would take something like 100 years to get to every workplace once, and that's, you know, just not possible. So we need a much stronger OSHA. We need amendments to the OSHA Act that are going to give OSHA the authority to impose truly severe penalties on egregious violators. Right now, if an employer puts his worker's life at risk and knowingly, negligently, but does it anyway, and that worker dies, the worst that OSHA can do, the worst that the Department of Justice can do, is charge that employer with a misdemeanor, like a traffic ticket.
Yep. I've often said if I wanted to kill somebody, I would just hire them on. I'd hire them as an employee, and I'd set them up.
Exactly.
Because I would get away with it.
You can get is 6 months in jail then.
Yep. And there's something seriously wrong with this. But, you know, here's the thing, Tom. You know, when I look at this situation, because I can, when it happened, I said, you know, I'll bet almost my last dollar that those workers there didn't have a union, that they weren't organized, that they didn't have a voice on the job. And for me, the answer in this, knowing that it's going to be 100 and some years before OSHA gets to every workplace, is for every workplace to say, you know what? We better stick together. We better come together because we know the job. We know what's right and wrong. Here at the local facility, we hold them accountable through collective bargaining, through contracts, through, you know, just making people aware.
Yep.
You know, I like OSHA. I like the fact that you have this and we should be strengthening it. Yes. But I'm a firm believer in empowering workers. The guy who's looking at that situation every day, day after day, empowering him to say, hell no, I'm not going near that. I want to go home to my family at night.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head, Rick. I mean, no matter how many resources we devote to OSHA, no matter how many inspectors, they're never going to be able to be in every workplace. And the only way that workers can truly protect their health and safety is if they have the authority to speak up about safety and health hazards without fear of retaliation, without fear that they're going to lose their job because they're speaking up. And, you know, that requires, in most cases, the backing of a union. to be able to, you know, stand behind a worker who's going to speak up for their health and safety and have, you know, in the contract provisions that are going to allow them to do that. And the other part of that is we need truly effective whistleblower protections. Right now, the OSHA's whistleblower protection program is just not effective in protecting workers who speak up. So we got to improve that as well.
Now, there's a lot of work to do, but the sad reality is in the climate that we're in politically, business friendly seems to be the statement of the day, and deregulate, and the invisible hand will take care of it. The sad reality is that the invisible hand's been giving us the invisible finger, and we end up having tragedies like this. And as you've pointed out, those 15 workers killed that day, well, that's what happens in this country almost every day. And to me, all of that can be avoided by common sense, by holding people accountable, by, you know what, maybe a little less productivity, a little more consciousness of what's around us.
That's right. That's right. And then let's hope that the tragedy in Texas makes people think twice about the whole anti-regulatory movement. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, has touts Texas as the most business-friendly state in the country, and you know, tries to avoid these so-called burdensome regulations. And as a result, we have situations like this that happen in Texas. And we have a daily fatality rate in Texas that's twice that of another large, complicated state like California. So, you know, there is a real cost to that anti-regulatory attitude.
Now, last question I've got for you, because you bring up the costs in this. And for me, it's the cost to the community as well. I mean, you know, it's one thing for business to be able to do what they want. And, you know, I've been talking about the externalities and how we've allowed business to pollute and to cause, you know, things like this to happen. And who's left holding the bag? Who's left cleaning all this up? What's going to happen to this town now that this employer is now completely wiped off the map? And with it, a whole bunch of destruction and devastation. You know, what happens to that community?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a near impossible rebuilding task for that community. And, you know, the general public is going to be left holding the bag, as you said, because of some bad decisions by the management of that plant.
And they're going to end up walking away. And it's, we've seen this time and time again, which is why I am a firm believer in regulation. I'm a firm believer in oversight. There's got to be a cop on the beat, or this is the kind of stuff we end up with. Tom O'Connor, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Executive Director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health. This is just an absolute tragedy. Quick break. Back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children. AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
We need a third party to save this country. Not Ron Paul and the Ron Paulites. No, we need a legitimate third party to challenge the current system that we have. Because I don't believe that the Republican Party, although I ran as a Republican, I have been voting Republican for decades, I don't believe the Republican Party has the ability to rebrand itself.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Pete DeFazio, the Democrat from Oregon, has introduced a piece of legislation that is going to remove the insanity that the Bush administration heaped upon the Postal Service. You may remember back in 2006, the Republicans back then, you know, made this little decision. We're going to save the Postal Service, they thought. We're going to make them pre-fund their pension and their employee health benefits for 75 years. 75 years, yeah. And they're going to have to do that in the next 10. Think about that for a second. We're going to take all of this whole benefit program that they've been running for years, and we're going to now put this new mandate on that you're going to have to do it for 75 years into the future, and you're going to have to do it over 10 years. Huge amount of money. So, of course, they can't do it. Set up to fail. In 2012, the Postal Service lost almost $16 billion. There's something seriously wrong with how things are done. Now, there was an analysis done in 2000 from 2012 that estimated had the Postal Service not had this mandate thrown on them, had it not happened, had it not gone into effect, that the operating ratio and the costs and everything would have given the Postal Service about a $1.5 billion surplus. Instead of this massive almost $15.9 billion loss, they would have had a $1.5 billion surplus, all because of this mandate, as I've called it, this poison pill that was designed to destroy the post office. Look, the Republicans knew that no one would go for privatization. They knew that. Nobody was going to buy that. They tried it during the Reagan years. Nobody was buying it. It was like 85% of the public said, hell no, because second only to nurses, postal workers are seen as some of the most trusted, most respected people in this country. Think about that. So what you've got to do is you can't go after the postal worker. No, no. You go after, wow, they're broke. Their technology's killing them. They can't compete. So with this piece of legislation that DeFazio's come up with, he said, look, we don't want the Postal Service to do away with the 5-day delivery. are doing away with the 6-day delivery. It should be 6 days. Stop with the killing yourself. Get back into overnight delivery standards. Stop closing these mail processing plants. The faster you can get mail moving through the system, the better. Contraction, not a good thing. Stop that. Also, end the 2006 ban that prohibits the Postal Service from offering new products and services. They can't even make new stuff up. Show me a business in this country where you say, you know what, you can exist, but you can't do anything else ever again. What you're doing right now, think about the telephone companies. If we would have said, you know what, the people who make telephones, you can't make anything other than rotary dial phones. I know the push buttons are coming, but you can't do it. Only rotary dial. You're really dooming them to death. And you know that that's what it is. You know you're setting this up for failure. And that's the point. This was passed by a bunch of people who despise government. Anything that they can privatize, and look, Trader Joe Lieberman was one of them. But this was set up to destroy it. Why? Well, FedEx. I just read a piece the other day. It says, you know what we should do with the post office? Disband the whole damn thing. Let FedEx deliver our mail and let Walmart be the post office. Because there's a Walmart in every community. Because Walmart's going to be everything. Think about that. And when I read that piece, I was wondering, what if there was a mandate that said, okay, Walmart, if you want to be in our community, you have to put Bob's Grocery Store in your Walmart, and you have to let them put their products on your shelves, and you can't charge them anything. I wonder what Walmart would think of that. And you go, well, that's obscene. That's ridiculous. No one would ever do that. Why is it that we put FedEx boxes in every postal service? Why is it we got FedEx boxes in the post office? Why is that? Why can't the post office offer their own service to do that? Does it make any sense to you? Doesn't make any sense to me. But you know who it makes sense to? People who want to destroy the post office. Think about that for a second. I mean, let it really sink in. They've saddled this public good, something that constitutionally was mandated. And they say, well, you know what? We can't privatize it. People won't go for that. They like their postman. They like the postal woman. I like the woman who delivers my mail. So what are we going to do? Well, defund it. Make people think, oh, it's broke. Oh, it's inefficient. Oh, it's outdated. We're so much past that. Nonsense. Nonsense. You know what I like about the post office? Delivers to every house in the country. Delivers everywhere. I like that I can put a stamp on for 45 cents and I can get a letter anywhere in the country within a couple of days. I like that. I think it's important. I think it's good for business. I think it's good for a country. Problem is, not enough profit in it. And it's not supposed to be. It's a public good. Just a thought. If you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com is where you get the podcast. Stitcher. We're going to take a quick break back with Hour 3. Stick around.
Majority. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. A U.S. steel plant in Canada could soon face its second lockout in less than 4 years.
Jesse Russell reports.
Workers at a U.S. steel plant in Canada have rejected the company's most recent contract offer. By a vote of 70%, the workers, who are represented by the United Steelworkers, voted down the contract. The union is asking the company to come back to the bargaining table. If the company refuses, the union has the power to call a strike by the end of the week. U.S. Steel could also lock out the workers, a move the plant has been preparing for in recent weeks. They've idled a blast furnace and have trained managers and other non-union staff on how to handle production work. This wouldn't be the first time workers at the plant have faced a lockout. U.S. Steel employed the tactic in 2010, denying employees access to work for 8 months. According to the union, workers are unhappy with the number of concessions the company is seeking. Some of the concessions are related to cost of living allowances, holidays, pensions, and benefits.
Hundreds of Chicago fast food restaurant and retail workers walked off their jobs Wednesday starting at 5:30 a.m. Workers at McDonald's, Subway, Dunkin' Donuts, Macy's, Sears, and Victoria's Secrets joined the job action in Chicago. The strike was because the workers want living wages that really support families and the right to form unions without interference from employers. Victor Guzman works at a Chicago McDonald's making the state minimum wage of $8.25 an hour.
We are fighting because we have to pay food, I have to pay school, and I have to pay my bills. So $8.25 is not enough.
This worker action is part of the Fight for 15 campaign, seeking a livable wage of at least $15 an hour at fast food and retail businesses. The Workers' Organizing Committee of Chicago says the Fight for 15 campaign is working to put more money into the pockets of 275,000 fast food and retail workers in the Chicago area. The biggest fast food workers' strike was in New York City just a few weeks ago. At a news conference in Washington Wednesday, flight attendants, including the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA, continued to push back against the TSA policy of allowing small knives back on passenger planes. The unions representing flight attendants say no knives on planes ever again. The policy change has been delayed. Veda Shook, president of AFA-CWA, says her union will not stand down from the fight to keep knives off planes. She says the union is focused on a legislative path that would permanently ban knives from commercial airline passenger cabins. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
They blame, with some justification, the problems in the financial sector for getting us into this mess. And they're dissatisfied with the policy response here in Washington. And at some level, I can't blame them. Certainly, 9% unemployment and very slow growth is not a very good situation.
At some point, I can't blame them for being angry that the banks crashed our economy and are foreclosing on people daily. Yeah, on some level, I can understand their anger. Well, you know, I've met people who have been foreclosed on. I've met people who are struggling as a result of the great crash of 2008. And there is this growing anger. There is this growing pushback against the big banks that crashed our economy and continue to throw people out of their homes. And I saw this story in Minnesota that grabbed my attention, where, you know, these college kids are taken to their college saying, hey, you know what? Wells Fargo, got to get them out. Which is why I've asked Maya Peisel, a senior at McAllister College there in Minnesota, to come talk to us about the events they've been having the past couple of days as students have become human blockades and going back to the days of sit-down strikes. To me, good stuff. Maya, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you.
Explain to me what's going on at McAllister College.
Well, we are occupying the administrative building. We've been here since Tuesday morning. And this morning we blockaded all the entrances to this building and negotiated for a meeting with our college president tomorrow to put the cutting the contract back on the table.
And why are you doing this? What's the ask? What's the demand? What are you looking for?
Well, the foreclosure crisis has totally devastated the Twin Cities. We've seen it in our families, in our neighborhoods, in our public schools. Be complicit in this crisis.
So what are we asking to do? To divest from Wells Fargo, take their money out, maybe go to a community bank?
We're asking the college to move their business out of Wells Fargo and put it into Sunrise Community Bank, a locally owned, socially responsible bank that invests in our community right here. It's feasible. It's revenue neutral.
See, to me, that's the answer to all of this. Get away from these too big to fail banks. In fact, just leave them entirely. Then they won't be too big to fail. Start propping up local community banks. I look at North Dakota, for instance, as an example. The state of North Dakota owns the North Dakota Bank. They didn't have the same problems that the rest of the banking industry had. Why? Because they were making loans based on, can you afford to take out this loan? Is it good for the community? Is it good for the bank? Are we doing smart things instead of just churning out mortgage after mortgage after mortgage and causing this massive bubble that's really benefited only a handful at the very top?
Yeah, that's totally right. And we think that we have the power as students, as institutions, as local communities to re-regulate the banks, even if the government won't.
So what kind of pushback are you getting from the administration? I can't imagine that they were all too thrilled that a bunch of students came and occupied the administration building.
No, they're not thrilled. We've been pretty disruptive. We've made it almost impossible for them to do their jobs. And they've gone to great lengths to avoid even meeting with us on this issue. So that's why we're so excited. This is a big victory for us to have a meeting tomorrow. It's easier for them to side with the status quo than to confront this crisis.
I mean, for me, I look at this and I have no idea why administrators pull this nonsense, because it only strengthens resolve, in my view. You know, what would have been the harm in sitting down from the beginning and talking instead of having to go through this whole thing?
Well, I think they're feeling more pressure from Wells Fargo than they are from students. So we ramped up the pressure.
And what kind of support are you getting in the community?
We've been working with community groups, labor groups, faith groups since the beginning. In fact, this campaign grew out of a few of our involvement with Occupy Homes Minnesota. We're proud to work with Minnesotans for a Fair Economy, SEIU, Isaiah, Neighborhoods Organizing for Change. So we have a lot of support in the community, and people who are fighting foreclosure in their neighborhoods totally inspire the work that we do.
And what I like about this, and I got to be honest with you, you hear a lot of talk about the student loan situation, and I'm hoping at some point in the very near future we see a ton of organizing around students going, you know what, you've saddled us with these massive student loans. We've got to figure out how to fix this crisis. But what I like about this is for most people that are doing this, I would assume that their families aren't being foreclosed on. This is for the betterment of the community, for the good of all of us, not just narrow self-interest.
That's right. We do have some people in our campaign who this is a personal issue in their own homes, but it's also a personal issue for those of us whose homes aren't being foreclosed, because this affects our public schools. Schools are being closed down. More than a dozen schools in just one neighborhood were closed down in the last few years. And so that affects our little brothers and sisters, our cousins, the kids we go to school with, and ultimately, like, the health of our democracy and our economy.
You know, what popped into my head when I saw that you had this sit down, the strike, and where you're occupying this, you know, I was wondering if there was any, you know, did they call in the security people to try and intimidate you and call in the police to try and strong arm you? Did you see any of that?
There's been security here the entire time, but we are friendly with some of the security guards who we've worked with in the past, and the police were never called. We're thankful about that. A few of us were arrested in an earlier action in solidarity with Minnesotans for a Fair Economy and SEIU for disrupting some traffic in February.
Yeah, sometimes traffic gets in the way.
Well, it was intentional. We sat down in front of the Wells Fargo Home Mortgage Center. So.
And good for you. I mean, at the end of the day, we need to be drawing attention to what these banks have done, because, you know, the sad reality is the mainstream corporate-controlled media not really all that concerned anymore. They look at Wall Street and say, hey, everything's back to normal. We're fat and happy. The CEO paid back. The corporate profit's back. Everything's wonderful now.
Well, but people in their homes know that's not true, so we want to make sure that story gets out.
So let me ask you, as you've organized this, what advice would you give to other communities? Because I think this is something that has to be done, not just in Minnesota, but all across this country, and not just on foreclosures, but on a whole plethora of issues. What's the advice?
I would say we have the power. We are a lot stronger than we know. And when we come together as neighborhoods, as students, we can stand up and show big banks, show big corporations that this bullying will not stand.
Last line of questioning I've got for you. What do you expect to come out of the meeting with the president? And if it doesn't go a positive way, if he doesn't listen, or if it goes, where do you plan on going in the day after?
Well, we hope that he will choose to cut the contract tomorrow and stand with us, with Main Street, with McAllister Values, with our local community. And if he doesn't, we're not going anywhere. Choices have consequences, and we're prepared for either choice. We could keep going on this campaign for 3 more years.
Wow, good for you. And again, my hope is that, the reality, the hope is that he comes around and does the right thing. But there's part of me that goes, the moneyed interests, they don't care about us. They don't care about people at the bottom.
Yeah.
But I wish you guys nothing but the best of the luck, and I'd love to find out what happens tomorrow.
Well, thank you. We'll definitely keep you posted.
Thank you so much, Maya. Maya Piesel, senior at McAllister College. And, this is the kind of stuff that I think we need to be seeing more often. And the reason that I bring folks on the program to talk about this is because this stuff is happening. And it's happening a lot more than we see. This kind of pushback, this kind of blowback from bad policy, from bad systems. Understand, we set this stuff up. We allowed these structures to thrive. It was the people that we put into political office I remember back in the 90s where you had the Greenspans of the world and you had the Wall Street people saying, oh, we learned our lesson. We would never do what, the robber barons of yesteryear did. We would never do that. We learned the lessons from the Great Depression. We wouldn't create that bubble again. No, we learned. And what'd they do? They got Graham Leach Bliley, the economic development, I forget what the name of it is, the thing that Clinton signed that undid Glass-Steagall. And how long did it take? 8 years to bring an economy that was moving towards debt-free, that was growing, that was employing, Clinton created some 23 million jobs during his span. It was a red-hot economy. And it just 8 short years because of a bad decision, bad policy. Look what we ended up with. A lost decade. Something wrong with that. And as easily as they undid Glass-Steagall and as easily as they gave all that power up, I think we can get it back. But it's going to take people in the street. Nothing comes without struggle. Nothing comes without sacrifice. Nothing comes without conflict. And I'm glad to hear that it's peaceful. And I'm glad to hear that they're not shooting mace and they're not shooting tear gas and they're not bringing in the sound cannons. That should be happening to we, the people. And at a certain level, they've got to know this is our country. So I'm glad to hear it. Good stuff. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. Car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle. New or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want.
At PSECU, we'd love to help you get the ride you're drawn to. Buy the car you truly want with a loan you can afford. car, truck, minivan, SUV, scooter, or cycle, new or used, we have a solution for you. Get a rate as low as 1.49 annual percentage rate. Additional rates and terms are available. With PSECU, you can get the ride you truly want. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to PSECU.com/life today.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal Opportunity Lender.
Factory farms are not farms at all. They are corporate-run concentration camps for pigs, cows, chickens, turkeys, and other food animals. Held in corporate confinement, these creatures of nature are denied any contact with their natural world. Instead, being crammed by the thousands into concrete and metal buildings where they are locked in torturously tiny cages for the duration of their so-called life, which is nasty, brutish, and short. All so food giants like Tyson, Smithfield, and Borden can grab fatter and quicker profits. It's so disgusting that America's consumers would gag at the sight of it. That's why the profiteers are desperate to keep you from knowing what goes on inside their factories. Nonetheless, word has been getting out as animal rights advocates, consumer groups, unions, and others have exposed some of the disgusting realities of animal confinement to the public, including showing wretch-inducing photos and videos. Rather than cleaning up their act, however, the industrial food powers have simply doubled down on disgusting. Their lobbyists have been swarming state legislatures to demand passage of laws that single out anyone who reveals the industry's ugly secrets, summarily stripping such whistleblowers of their constitutional right of free speech. This is Jim Hightower saying, the only thing that will gag you worse than viewing the gross animal abuse taking place in these factories is to look at the grossly repressive and aptly named ag gag bills moving through the legislative sausage mills of various states. The bills are ridiculous, but so are some legislatures, where corporate money trumps both common sense and the Constitution. Six states have passed ag gag laws, and six more are moving towards passage. To see what's happening in your state, go to www.humanesociety.org. That's humanesociety.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Last year, 120,000 people over the age of 60 in the United States of America had their Social Security payments garnished because of student loan debt. It is a multi-generational crisis. And anybody who has, you know, sweated over their sons and daughters' student loan payments knows that it's not just about students, it's about all of us.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So the president was in Texas today while he gave the speech there in West Texas about the fertilizer plant that went boom. And again, I'm if I was a betting man, there's negligence there. Just a thought. But he also gave a speech at the George W. Bush Presidential Library in Dallas, Texas, which will be open to the public on May 1st. We're going to be going through there because I have to go. I have to go see the what they've done to rewrite the Bush presidency. And in fact, you know, we're going to be going from here to San Jose, California for Netroots Nation in June, and then back. We're going to run down 40 down the bottom of the country, and then come across 80 across the middle. And highlight all the areas that we think are important. You know, look at labor history sites, look at worker history sites, things that I think made this country great, things that I think are important for my kids to see, with an idea that, you know what, this is a great country, and what made it that way? You, me, we the people, not the billionaires, not the very wealthy. Us, the hardworking folks, and I'm gonna I've scheduled a whole day just to go through the Bush Library, because you know I want to see, you know, what's there, what did they choose to highlight his presidency. Will the big, will the Mission Accomplished banner be there? Will there be a picture of him standing under the mission? Remember the Mission Accomplished banner with the outfit, the flight suit? Remember that? And what I love is the background story to the Mission Accomplished banner, where they, the Bush spokespeople said, you know, the people on the aircraft carrier were just so overjoyed that they put that banner up. They made the banner themselves. They put it up there. You go, wait a second. I'm led to believe they're out to sea, right? How'd they come up with a massive banner that big? Do they have a print shop on the aircraft carrier that big that could make that huge of a sign? Do they really? Interesting. I would think that, you know, bombs and stuff like that would be more important than big sign making material. But hey, maybe I'm wrong. But I would love to see that. I'm wondering if it's there. If you remember that whole event, they weren't too far off the coast, a couple miles. In fact, they had to actually turn the aircraft carrier around so that the photo would be out to sea, so you wouldn't see land right behind them. That would be a bad photo op, wouldn't it? And I guess there's going to be a lot of pictures because, in my view, the Bush presidency was the photo op presidency because they did a lot of photo ops. Especially with troops, man. You know, you would think that they loved the troops, that they were the best administration for soldiers. But when you look at the realities, the defunding, the fact that you put wars on a credit card, ran up the debt, the fact that you did all of those things, just saying. So it'll be interesting to see. Maybe we'll see the bullhorn that he used at the Ground Zero site. I'm sure that will be a centerpiece. I'm sure there'll be a lot of stuff about 9/11. I'm sure there'll be a lot of stuff about Hurricane Katrina. And what I would find interesting about that, and I'm hoping they highlight both of those, because I consider both of those failures. And like the guy who told me today that, you know, that George kept us safe. Boston wouldn't happen on George's watch. Kept us safe. Except for that day in September. I wonder how much of that'll be in it. But I saw an article on some of the really popular presidential museums and the least popular. And they said that the least popular presidential museum in the country was the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, Iowa. And you would think, and you know, again, I'm just judging, you know, my understanding of history. You know, the guy who caused the Great Depression, you would think most people wouldn't want to remember him. Which is why they only had about 44,000 people who visited his presidential library and museum. I'm wondering how many people will go to the Bush Museum, because he is the guy who caused almost the next Great Depression, right? The Hoover Library is also the smallest with 47,000 square feet. Now, on the other side of that coin, you've got the George W. Bush Presidential Library, 226,560 square feet. A whole bunch of Hoovers, if you will. $500 million they raised for the library. Now, the Hoover Library has the smallest collection of any amount of stuff. The Nixon Library has a bunch of stuff. The most expensive being the Bush Library, the least expensive. And this is what caught my attention. This is one of those things that you go, exactly. You know, it's a complete difference in ideology. It's a complete difference in how people viewed each president. So you've got the Bush Library as by far the most expensive in history. And then you've got the FDR Presidential Library up in New York. The least expensive, which would have cost just $6 million to build. So you've got $500 million George W. Bush raised while we're cutting libraries, while we're cutting librarians, while we're destroying education. While we're doing that, we're building this mammoth monument to a guy who, I'm sorry, I'm just not fond of. And, you know, I can think of a bunch of reasons why I don't want another Bush in the White House. You know, as I said before, the only two times I've ever been laid off in my life that I've lost a job, or I didn't lose it. I knew where it was. It's just that nobody else was doing it. It was done away with. I didn't lose it. It was done away with. And there was a Bush in the White House each time. Back in the early 90s, George H.W. Bush was there, and then right after little Junior took, I was off for about 2 months, I think. Something wrong with that. I wonder how much in the, and this is something I'm hoping to find out, I wonder how much of the Wall Street collapse he's going to take credit for. Since it was a lot of his policies of pushing more deregulation that we saw during the 2000s that added on top of the Graham-Leach-Bliley, the Clinton piece of legislation. I wonder how much credit he'll take for that, how much time they'll spend on that. Because I don't think an awful lot. You know, when I look at this library is really about reinventing who he was, reinventing the presidency, trying to undo the damage that he did. It's about the legacy. And I read an article today that said, well, you know, over time, his legacy will soften. People will forget because we're amnesic, that we do forget. And that the historians, and this was the thought, is that the historians will be kinder because there's going to be an awful lot written over the next two decades by the right-wing think tanks, by the people who want to, you know, they're going to blame that collapse in 2008 on Clinton. And look, there's some responsibility. The fact that he signed the Financial Services Modernization Act in 99, Graham-Leach-Bliley. The fact that he signed that doing away with Glass-Steagall, which set up the conditions that led to 2008. Now, let's not forget, Bush took office with a surplus. Bush took office with a projection in the next decade of being debt-free. Bush took office with a huge an economy that was moving in the right direction. It was slowing down, but it wasn't dying. And the right will have you believe, well, you know, Bush took office when there was a recession. No, the recession was caused by Bush because everybody knew what he was going to do. But here's the really bizarre, sad thing. The really bizarre, sad thing is part of me looks at the current Republican Party and pines for the George W. Bush administration. Because the folks who are running the Republicans right now are so far beyond even Bush, who wanted to privatize Social Security, who wanted to sell off and drill baby drill and do all of those things that the current Republicans are doing, but just not as far. Don't you think there's something wrong with that? But for me, the Bush administration, I got to be honest, I think of the attacks on workers' rights. I think of the widening income inequality. I think of the Supreme Court nominations and appointments. I think of a dysfunctional executive branch. I think of scandal. I think of Valerie Plame. I wonder if there will be an exhibit with the outing of Joe Wilson and Valerie Plame. I wonder if that's going to be in there. I wonder if you'll see much more on defunding stem cell research. And, you know, I wonder if the guitar will be there, that they were playing on the tarmac as people were drowning in New Orleans. I wonder if that will be there. But some of the other stuff that catches my mind. You go back to the authorizing the use of torture, this whole waterboarding thing, all the stress positions that we saw firsthand, all of the sleep deprivation, all of the sound, the sound, all of that. And I think about nothing to deal with climate change, nothing. In fact, more head in the sand. I wonder how much of that will be there. And I'm anxious to go. I really am. But not for a positive reason. But because I want to see how they're going to rewrite and doctor history. How they want to see him viewed. And it'll be interesting. And we may even stop by the Clinton Library because we're going to be going right through Little Rock, Arkansas as well. And I am looking forward to this trip. I've had a couple of people tell me they can't wait to hear what we get out of this. Cause we plan on going, to a bunch of places. The TVA, for instance, the Tennessee Valley Authority, since our president said, hey, let's sell that off. Maybe we should talk about that. And then when we go through Memphis, we'll talk about FedEx and misclassifying workers. And, of course, you can't go to Memphis without talking about the sanitation strike and economic justice and all of those topics and all of those things that I think we need right now more than ever. To remember, to understand, and to talk about, which is why we're doing this tour, and I'm excited as all can be. And of course, if you want to participate, there's something I'd like to hear, something I'd like to see, you can always email me your thoughts, your comments at rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back with Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
One of these days we're gonna wake up.
America for the better.
It was 75 years ago that Capital Blue Cross officially opened for business. From our earliest days, serving our customers has been at the heart of everything we do. Together we've lived history and made history. And we're here to help guide you as we navigate a new era in healthcare together. Explore affordable health insurance options and use our free online tools to search for a provider, look up treatment costs, and more. All at capbluecross.com. Capital Blue Cross, celebrating 75 years of service. Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Didn't know Cheech and Chong was back in college. Yes, well, at least one of them, someone at the University of California, Santa Cruz, on 420 day, brought a, I don't even know how it's possible, rolled a 2-pound joint. Now, that exceeds, just by a little bit, the state's legal weight limit of 1 ounce. So maybe, and I guess the defense would be that education has gotten so poor in the country that, you know, didn't realize the difference between ounces and pounds. Just a thought. Maybe he just learned the metric system, didn't get that whole ounce pound thing. Interesting though. Two pounds, about 2 feet long. Imagine Cheech and Chong. Imagine the smoke coming out of that van. Anyway, let's go to Washington, D.C. I've got Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, great to be here. And actually, I went to UC Santa Cruz back when I was 16 through 19, when I was taking college courses in high school.
Two pounds.
I got to say, I was around a lot of weird stuff. but I do not believe I have ever smoked a 2-pound joint. But maybe I did and do not remember it. But,
I missed out on that. I never, and this isn't just, you know, pandering. I have never taken any illegal drugs. I've never smoked pot even once in my life.
Really?
Yeah, and it's not because I'm prude or I have I just thought I would be the best drug addict possible, and I'd probably be the guy on the corner with the tin can going, hey, I need a fix.
No, I certainly respect that, but, you know, I come from California, and I spent a lot of time in Humboldt, so I know many a deadhead who took things way too far.
Oh, I knew tons of them. I've never seen anyone roll a 2-pound, 2-foot-long joint. Never.
Well, from what I understand it, at that festival, there were a bunch of people who were taking small donations from a group of other people to build a, large marijuana smoking cigarette. And it just happened to grow to 2 feet with all of the excess that people had available.
So, well, there you
can't
go.
Really blame them, I guess, for just, trying to be good Samaritans and, combining resources.
It's all part of the community, man.
Exactly.
In fact, the right wing shouldn't be upset about the drug part of it. It's that socialism. They're socializing pot. There's something wrong with that.
They certainly are. I mean, if this was if they were charging it, I guess, or if this was a enterprise trying to collect marijuana for a, per charge hit joint, I guess that'd be much different, but no, this was a free-for-all, so therefore we cannot have that.
Yeah. Well, good. Well, good. I'm not against it. Do what you got to do. At least they didn't go around shooting people or blowing things up. And I see the Boston bombing. Now the fingers are waving. The blame has begun. Well, it's been heating up. But John Boehner, Lindsey Graham, Jim Risch, a whole bunch of people coming out and pointing fingers.
Yes, they certainly are. There is now a concerted effort underway to try to blame a whole myriad of people, one of which, of course, is the FBI for not going far enough to have a terror watch list that was properly spell-checked, because it looks like the older suspect's name was misspelled on that. We also have a number of people who are trying to look into whether or not it is a wise move to try him as in non-enemy combatant on U.S. shores. And, of course, that's going to, lay way to a major war over who or who is not a terrorist in America. And it's coming at a weird time, of course, where a lot of libertarians are really split on the issue. And, we just don't really know what's going to come out of this.
Yeah, I'm of the mindset, and as bad as it sounds and as I took the side of the Westboro Baptist Church that they have the right to say, even as insane as I believe it is and as stupid as it is, they have the right to say what they say. This guy's a citizen, and he's got the same rights. And, your rights are good times and bad times. They are what they are, I think. And we prosecute him under our law, and you deal with him with our laws. If not, what makes us any better?
No, certainly true. And, of course, we have a new suspect who has entered into the mix by the name of Misha. And we are not sure if this is somebody who has just sort of provided, pure support to the older suspect. And whether or not he would be somebody who would be able to be tried remains to be seen. We do know that an older propaganda minister for Al-Qaeda was killed recently in an American drone attack without due process, even though he was an American citizen. So it really is sort of a gray legal issue.
Yeah, I had someone tell me today, and it just made me stop dead in my tracks, because we were talking about the Bush Library, and I was wondering if they would have any look and find books in there, since he didn't bother to look for Bin Laden and he didn't find him. And this person actually looked at me and said, this wouldn't have happened if George W. Bush was president. He kept us safe. And I just stopped and said, I don't know how to respond to that.
It certainly is a weird issue. We know that there is a lot of revisionist history that has gone on with the Bush Library. We know that apparently there is a choose-your-own-adventure element to the library where you could be presented with the situation that George Bush faced. And I guess upon being presented information that a country with about 19 Saudi Arabian hijackers and whatnot who are not from Iraq, would therefore lead to an invasion of the country. So, you know, I guess it's still a pretty logical issue in Bushland.
See, if I were in Bushland, if you put me in that situation, you give me the information that they had, the logical choice would have been to invade Saudi Arabia. Because if we were purely going on the people's national heritage of, you know, who did fly the planes, it's my recollection, and maybe you're the smarter guy here, but most of them were from Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, no, that is certainly true, and I don't claim to be the smarter guy, but that would certainly make sense. But nevertheless, according to the Bush Library, we invaded Iraq because it made sense. Even though there was no weapons found, they apparently still had the capacity to make them, which makes total sense considering how we absolutely invaded not just North Korea, but Iran and many other countries as well.
Yeah, I can't wait to go to the Bush Library. We're heading down there in June as we embark on our labor history tour across the country to look at what made our country great. And we're going to take the detour through. We're going to find out what made the country great, taking a detour through the Bush Library, also down to West Texas, to look at the explosion site of the fertilizer plant and talk to people in that community. But I can't wait to see the Mission Accomplished banner. I can't wait to see it. In the flight suit with the sock in the pants. Is that going to be there?
There's certainly a lot of fond moments, I guess, to a certain extent, that a lot of people have over it. We know that, Condoleezza Rice, as well as a number of chiefs of staff, took part in the library and appeared in a number of videos. Nevertheless, it looks like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld are not in the videos at the library, which may mean that maybe they were not the... foreign policy experts that they pretended to be.
Yeah, I can't wait to see the big sign that says, I'm the decider.
He was the decider. I guess the public now has a chance to decide. And if they are judging fully on the message from the Bush Library, they are probably going to come down on his side of history. But there are a lot of people who remember what happened during those 8 years, and I do not believe they are going to be falling on the decider side.
No, well, I look at the money that some $500 million he raised for a library for a guy who, you know, can't seem to put two words together. I'm not saying he's dumb, but, you know, and I look at the fact that we're defunding libraries all across this country. I look at Philadelphia, for instance, where they're doing away with all librarians. And you go $500 million for a library dedicated to a guy who, in my view, was a failed president. While at the same time we're defunding, and maybe this is all part of the grand scheme to make Bush look a lot better. I don't know. Maybe it is.
You know, it could very well be. You know, it does not look like sequestration is really playing a major part in this, even though we all know that there is a reason why we are in the economic fiasco that we are in, and that is primarily due to the wars of choice that we pursued during his presidency. So,
yeah.
You know, there's certainly a lot of questions surrounding his decisions, and, you know, thank God we have an official library to help us sort of through that.
Yeah, so I guess Obama spoke basically talking about immigration, giving Bush credit for immigration. I go, well, you know, why stop there? Give him all the credit for the trade policies that you keep pursuing, you know, the Colombia, the South Korea, the Panama, and now the Trans-Pacific Partnership Free Trade Agreement. Make sure you give him credit for those, as well as the immigration policy, as well as a lot of other things that have gone on. Maybe hell, the sale of the Tennessee Valley Authority, too. Why not that, too?
No, it certainly goes beyond that. We know that for a fact. President Obama has been pursuing a number of national security policies. We know that the recent exhibition in Boston could not have been provided unless it was for the Patriot Act. We know that the Obama administration has certainly kept open the prison in Guantanamo Bay. And we know that the Obama administration is certainly following lockstep in a lot of positions that the Bush administration has struck. But nevertheless, I guess immigration reform was the one thing that was politically popular to really harp upon. And we saw Obama giving him some glowing praise, saying, thanks to him 7 years ago, we saw the conversation about immigration reform really being kickstarted. And, you know, even though we haven't really seen any movement on the issue for 7 years, he is still somebody who deserves a wide array of credit, even though we really saw nothing happen under his tenure.
Yeah, and let's not forget, you know, going after privatizing Social Security and destroying that. Now we got the president, you know, saying, hey, let's have change CPI. Yay! Lower benefits. Let's get fired up about that.
No, certainly true. You know, this is something that Bush had pursued, you know, following his 2004 election where he's trying to privatize it. It was a grotesque manipulation of the entitlement program. We see a similar situation today. And, you know, we do not see the same kind of forces coming out, fully opposing it like we saw back then. But nevertheless, this idea does not seem any more economically feasible today than it did back then.
So let's talk about the immigration bill. I understand the Senate passed its version, I guess, right?
They did not pass their version, but they have moved forward with an 844-page overarching piece of legislation. And now it looks like the House is going to be pursuing that in a much more limited fashion. Instead of going after these big things that really need to be achieved, such as a path to citizenship or whatnot, we are now seeing them going after a piecemeal approach.
Guest worker program.
Exactly. We're now going to see them going after a guest worker program for agricultural workers, as well as an e-verify system for employers. But none of this, of course, is going to really address the controversial issues. And instead, we're probably going to see a very watered-down immigration bill at the end of the day because of the House's, hesitancy to enact, more bolder legislation, even though that would probably save the Republican Party at this point.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, look, the Republicans want cheap labor and business-friendly. All that other stuff, I think they're willing to do without. I think they're afraid of their radical base right now, but I think you're right, down the road it hurts them. Also, I guess there's been some talk of a Jeb library at some point in the future. Family kind of split?
There has been some discussion, but it does not look like the Bush family is unified behind it. We saw President George Bush appearing with an interview with ABC's Diane Sawyer saying that Jeb Bush does not need his counsel, and in fact, this would be a great decision to run. But today on NBC's Today, we saw Barbara Bush appearing and saying that the country does not need any more Bushes, saying that, the First Lady, that there are, more than just four families that are appearing, and therefore it should be somebody else's shot, which is, pretty damning criticism for somebody who is running for president who is, in fact, your own son.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't want to see another Bush presidency. The only two times I've ever been unemployed in my life, there was a Bush in the White House, both the father and the son, both times unemployed. And
finally, very true. It's still a very unpopular name, and I think you'd probably at this point have a better chance of being elected with the last name Manson than Bush. So we'll see how that plays through.
Well, I'm going to quote you on that one. And finally, did Syria use chemical weapons?
That certainly is the $64,000 question that is being played out right now. We saw Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel come out today and say that with a reasonable level of confidence, it looks like America does believe, in fact, that Syria used chemical weapons. However, on a background call from the White House, we saw a senior administration official say that has not yet been fully determined, and that before we try to decide whether or not the Assad administration has the red line, we are going to have to look at that more closely. So, financial weapons, but at a certain level, the White House is still trying to buy time before they make a declaration that really would require some action on their part.
Yeah, I mean, if they, let's say they did, let's say for argument's sake, they did use chemical weapons, what are we going to do about it?
That's a very good question. Of course, there are some people who say that would require a no-fly zone or some other, foreign intervention. But nevertheless, we have not seen the White House really give a strict answer on that. We saw today in the background call just them saying that they would pursue a contingency plan, but that they did not have a strong emergency operation in place or any details that would really give any evidence of that. So it's a very odd question, and it's a very major development, and we'll try to see how the administration reacts to that.
I look forward to your next report to tell me what's going on. I appreciate it, Justin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Justin Duckham, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
Earth, sky, Thursday, April 25th. As seen from the Earth's eastern hemisphere, the full moon barely clips the Earth's dark umbral shadow for 27 minutes tonight, to present one of the shortest partial eclipses in the 21st century. At the greatest eclipse, the Earth's dark shadow will cover less than 1.5% of the moon's diameter.
From most of Europe and Western Africa, the moon will be partially eclipsed shortly after sunset tonight. As viewed from the Middle East and Western Asia, the partial eclipse will take place at late night or around midnight. And if you live in Australia, Indonesia, or Eastern Asia, the lunar eclipse will happen before sunrise tomorrow. Come to our website at earthsky.org to find out the precise times of tonight's partial lunar eclipse for your part of the world.
A lunar eclipse can only happen at full moon, or when the moon lies opposite the sun in Earth's sky. When Earth sits directly between the moon and sun, then the Earth's dark shadow totally covers the lunar disk. However, the alignment is a little off this time around, so it's only an exceedingly shallow partial lunar eclipse tonight. But the moon won't swing through the Earth's dark umbral shadow again until the total lunar eclipse of April 15, 2014.
People in the world's eastern hemisphere can watch tonight's partial eclipse of the full moon. And those missing the eclipse will still see a full-looking moon near the golden planet Saturn from dusk till dawn. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
We're at EarthSky.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. What they do.
Yes, they sure do, especially when they got their hand out and they want a boatload of money. And especially those people who, you know, wear the collar and tell you how religious they are. Love that one. Which is why this story from Pocono Mountain is so interesting. A state ethics commission issued a report. And the report found, or alleges, you know, since I guess he's going to be tried, State Ethics Commission report says that this reverend, the Reverend Dennis Bloom, founder of the Pocono Mountain Charter School, had a habit of, well, you know, enriching himself, or as the report says, self-dealing. They claim he broke the state ethics law rules and the conflict of interest rules, and he funneled himself about $1.5 million of taxpayer dollars. Got, you know, for him, got some for his family, you know, set up some businesses, you know, had this church that he thought, yeah, well, you know, I could just take the money from the school and give it right to the church, right? And if you remember the story not too long ago, paved the church parking lot, charged the school for it. Now, the 220 pages, figure this one out. I mean, imagine the stuff that's in this. I really want to take a look at it. Says that the former police officer turned ordained minister, well, he was lying in his pockets. And doing fairly well at that. Set up a sweetheart deal for himself, a nice lease. Opened up his charter school. Got about $920,000 from the taxpayers for the church, according to the report. His daughter got a job. His son got a job. His wife, assistant CEO, made $69,000 a year. They both had taxpayer-funded leases for cars. And what I find really great about that is you heard all during the last campaign, we're going to get rid of the leases for the cars, except for the people in the charter schools. And I look at this and I go, you know, the sad reality is what we've seen so much of is we've set this situation up where we bought the charter school stuff. We bought it all. And what do you end up with? Con men. Con men who are saying that they're going to run our schools. And how much money did we lose? I mean, it's just not $1.5 million at this point. $1.5 million that, you know what, was supposed to go into education. And that money's gone. It's not coming back. You're not going to recover it. You're not going to get it back. And my question becomes, how many more of these people are out there? How many of these charter schools are set up solely, well, to enrich the few? And this is a guy who says, I'm religious. Trust me. Preacher. I've always said, you know, the one who tells us, tells me how religious they are, that's kind of the one I watch out for. Because that's the, well, that's the scary one. Interesting story I saw over at ABC News. A crew team was out on the Hudson River. Marist College crew team. They were, you know, just, you know, doing the whole you know, rowing thing. Came across a 7 foot high fiberglass styrofoam head, big giant head, floating out in the Hudson River. And you go, wow, there's an economic, there's a ecological nightmare. They don't know where it came from. Could be came from New Orleans. Could be came from Sandy. Nobody knows. But this giant styrofoam head, they think it was part of Mardi Gras, and has found its way from New Orleans to the Hudson River. Big styrofoam head covered in fiberglass. And, you know, as it's floating out in the water, you got to wonder how long would that take to break down? And for me, when I read the story, because, you know, it's one of those things that I look at and I go, you know, the country is just, the world is just so small. And when we discard stuff in one place, where do you think it ends up? Which is why I think, you know, this whole drill baby drill and all of this climate stuff, we had better take seriously. We'd better take it seriously. Anyway, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, that's where you go to get the podcast, Stitcher for your smartphone. And if you want to email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, I would love to hear your thoughts, comments, for our grand bus tour, Discovering America. Going to take the whole crew. We're going out. We've rented an RV. We're going across country, and we're going to discover. And we're going to bring back to you the things that we find out. My kids, we'll probably hear from my kids a little bit. We've brought on a wonderful new person to come and help out with this. We're going to be writing a couple of books. There's a lot of things we're going to be doing, developing a website so that you can follow our tour, give us feedback along the way. I'm really excited about this. I think it's going to be an excellent opportunity to teach my kids more, to be honest. And, you know, to bring back some really great information and some great stories and really to discover stuff. You know, there are parts of the country that I haven't been to, that I've always wanted to. There are stories that are out there that I think are fascinating. As we're doing the legwork and the research, I cannot wait. Again, if you missed any portion of the program, TheRickSmithShow.com, Stitcher. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous raid. The mock